The legalized trade in drugs and pornography will contribute enormous amounts of VAT, allowing income tax to be abolished on all, except the lowest paid.
But the poorest would continue to pay income tax.
Someone has to.
Why?
Well, because poor people vote Labour, and so they'll get no favours from me. And the poor are the biggest consumers of government spending. Which brings me neatly onto my third point. The elimination of restrictive employment legislation. Quite simply, we don't need any. When was this country the leading industrial power in the world? When we sent children up chimneys, women down mines, and trade unionists to Australia. No coincidence, I contend.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. It's the 22nd. No, it's not. It's the 20th of January, 2021. And welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. As ever, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also joining me from Cornwall is Lloyds Bank fraud victim, and that's David Leighty. In part two, we look at the New Normal documentary. Really an absolutely fantastic documentary out this week. One of the best I've yet seen about COVID-19 and the effect that it's had on the world, and particularly here in the UK. It's called The New Normal, the documentary that should have been on TV, but wasn't. So, first, what's in that documentary? And secondly, we have a look at why is it not on television? The Century of the Lie. That's the present century. We look at the way, in the 21st century, opposing views to the official story have been banned. 9/11, 7/7, terrorist attacks, now lockdowns, which some say are killing more than COVID. That view, however, is banned. Instead, we have paid government radio ads saying that one third of Britons have COVID and are spreading it, as well as, if you break the rules, people will die. I'll say that again. If you break the rules, people will die. That's what they're saying, the government, with our money on the radio. And yet we're not allowed to discuss a lot of the medical side, particularly anti-vaccine. Even if those vaccines have hardly been tested, we're not allowed to discuss it, apparently. The massacre of the journalism in the UK. That's what we'll be talking about later. Also, the BBC 1926 PSYOP. Before Orson Welles and the War of the Worlds in the 1930s, 1926, the BBC were up to the same thing in a programme called Broadcasting from the Barricades. Pretended that there was a revolution going on in London. The House of Commons had been burnt down. This was produced and presented by a guy called Ronald Knox on the BBC in 1926. And because the country was snowed in, a lot of newspapers hadn't got round parts of the country. People thought the whole thing was real. In 1926, good old Ronald Knox. So we'll be talking about that, having a look at that. Also, the cruelty of the carers. The care home scandal revisited. A great ITV documentary last night, looking at the failures of care homes to care for residents. The suicide of a care home manager, even. And also the loving daughter and granddaughter that managed to prise their elderly mum out of a care home that wasn't caring for her. Also, the RT-PCR test, on which the UK government has put all its faith, is condemned by the World Health Organization, the WHO. Their guidance on masks still says they don't recommend them unless you have COVID symptoms to stop you spreading to others. Yet here in the UK, the COVID cops are running wild, the official ones and the unofficial little Hitlers, even bullying old people in the streets who don't wear a mask. And then finally tonight, eugenics, a Bill Gates family tradition. A good look at the spiffing British chap called Charles Galton Darwin. Techniques he suggested in his 1952 book, The Next Million Years, for getting rid of not just the family, but men's desire to procreate, leaving society with the help of chemicals with a vast pool of fertile women for the elite to procreate with. As he says, his name again, Charles Galton Darwin, as he says, one king, literally the father of his country. This maniac was a Brit and a great founding father, apparently, of eugenics. And you can hear a lot more of my longer interviews, the ones we don't have time to broadcast as part of this PRSC stream show, not the BCFM Politics Show, throughout the week on this stream. My three books were published in the 3 weeks of the Halloween lockdown, The Traitors of Arnhem, The Siege of Heaven and The Siege of Heaven Reader. I'm sending three versions of these out with my weekly email. And you can, of course, buy them at buyabilderberg.org or on the Martin Bormann tab of our show site. That's at thisweek.org.uk. So everything is there at thisweek.org.uk, including a place where you can make comments, etc. But first, some of this week's COVID developments and big lies, the globalist hysteria pandemic. Now, I thought we'd start this week by introducing David Leite. Now, we've had a long running investigation on this programme, really fueled by a chap called Trevor Mealham. He used to be a government advisor. And Trevor has been looking at the BSU, the Business Support Unit, rather badly named, Business Destruction Unit, it should possibly be, here in Castle Park in the centre of Bristol, Lloyds Bank. And Trevor has been looking at this for many years. We've also had the famous case of Noel Edmonds, who came to a private agreement with Lloyds Bank. And of course, Lloyds were more worried about him than others because of the fact that he was able to go and get publicity being who he was. And so they came to a private settlement with Noel Edmonds. But there are many, many other victims who they haven't. And these people have effectively been robbed. Now, much of this fraud began around the 1990s with something called the Blue Arrow case that we discussed several years ago now with journalist Ian Fraser and also with Rowan Bosworth Davis, who was a former fraud squad detective at the Metropolitan Police. And Rowan described at 3 a.m. going in and smashing in bankers' doors and arresting them. Who'd been involved in fraud. Now, one of the things Rowan explained was that after that case, the Blue Arrow case, and these top blue blood bankers he'd had arrested, they were only given a suspended sentence for a multi-million pound fraud. And then the Court of Appeal overturned the decision of the judge, and so they were let off completely, not even a suspended sentence. And from that time on, which was 1993, Rowan explains that the word came down on high that any financial crime was going to be now allowed in Britain. And of course, we've seen all sorts of, you know, alleged anyway, financial crimes, particularly with 2008, the financial crash and the bailouts this time. So that's a sort of an introduction, I suppose, to the Lloyds victims. David, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and what happened to you?
Hello, Tony, and hello, viewers or listeners. Yes, I'm from Cornwall. I'm a retired police detective. I did have a short scientific investigating career before that, and since that, I've investigated a lot of frauds. It happened when I went to build a retirement home in Cornwall, went to get a loan from Lloyds Bank to do some building work, build a house. We were going to build two, sell one and fund it. And they refused me a loan on affordability grounds. So we went off and got planning permission, made the site valuable, got funding from other sources, not particularly favourable rates, but fairly okay. And I had a phone call a year later out of the blue from Lloyds Bank saying, would I like to come in and discuss my current account with my wife and them to see if they could save me some money? Well, we pitched up in the bank, not knowing what it was about, and without discussing anything about reviewing our account, they offered us a loan to do some development on the two properties we were building, insisting that our domestic loan was lumped into the main loan, and one of the conditions of the loan was that we partnered up with a local reputable builder, having put it out to tender. Well, to cut a long story short, we did that. We got a builder on board, but then it started getting a little bit dodgy where he wouldn't sign a partnership agreement. So we decided that we'd tell the bank manager that it was no longer a partnership and maybe it shouldn't go ahead, at which we were told it's too late. The current account is opened in joint names and it's all ready to go. So we did proceed with caution, being absolutely promised that our safeguarding was that the bank manager would never release any money until she had received verified invoicing for expenditure that she could verify herself. Now, that is a fair good safeguarding because it was payment in arrears. She would pay only on a specific written agreed payment schedule month by month, fixed amounts on receipt of expenditure to those amounts. In other words, she was paying in arrears. So we proceeded on that basis of safeguarding by the bank. Within the first couple of weeks, I discovered that more than 80% of the loans had been released in two lump sums. The builder had had his hands on it and got those from the current account, and we had not seen any invoicing. So we'd immediately gone against the written agreement on the payment schedule, the valuation schedule, and the release schedule of funds that the bank manager herself stated was a concession. Which I mean is which I think they mean is a condition. They call them concessions, or they call them by some fancy name, but it's a condition of the loan. Having expressed serious concerns, the bank manager agreed that the builder needed keeping an eye on, and she moved his current account from Nuneaton, where he was, down to the local branch at Penzance, where she was, so she could keep an eye on him, in her words. Well, as time went on, she released another lump sum of 60,000 and another one of 20,000, which most of it he had. And then we come to find out that the buildings are of substandard, in such a substandard that they are only made of timber and plasterboard, and they are actually falling down, and they were just put up as a show to get the money out of the bank. Well, subsequently, I called the build off, reported the matter to the police and the bank within the hour. It took me 2 weeks to get the bank to respond to that. The builder was arrested three times on three separate accounts to do with this. He went to Crown Court and he was found guilty of defrauding Lloyds Bank by uttering a false instrument. Namely, the specimen charge was a £26,500 invoice for windows that never were. So we've got a guy now guilty of defrauding Lloyds Bank of this money. I then offer my services to Lloyds Bank as an ex-detective to say, well, I've now traced a lot of the money and a lot of the materials have been diverted to his private holiday home where he's doubled the value of it, and I can assist them on proceeds of crime. And they refused. They came after me and my wife and just said, basically, you have to pay us because we have a charge over your property. You pay us everything, all or nothing. Now, I'd already managed to save £40,000 from actually being diverted to the builder, which I then held in an account and offered it to the bank. Firstly, I was accused of stealing the money. And then, secondly, they refused to take it back and, quote, it's of such little value, it's not worth it, unquote. We're talking £40,000 to mitigate their losses. And I was then instructed to carry on with the build project. Obviously, I didn't know at this time it wasn't salvageable, and employ other people with the £40,000 to save the bank's interest in the matter. Time went on. The builder got a prison sentence suspended for a 6 month prison sentence suspended for 2 years for defrauding Lloyds Bank. But hey, one would think that would be the end of it. Well, Lloyds Bank refused to accept they'd been defrauded. They'd already withheld pertinent information to the police inquiry on two occasions from the detective, who got rather angry and came to me for the information. And then following that, I had to formally make a complaint because I offered the money back to the bank three times. And on another three times, I was told it is all or nothing. You have to pay us all or nothing. We're talking now the stolen money that he's been convicted of as well, plus interest on it. So I took umbrage at that. I made a formal complaint to Lloyds Bank, probably about 15 or 16 pages in showing the criminality and also pointing out the banking regulations. Well, following on from that, nothing happened month after month, despite my ringing up the recoveries department, I believe Bristol BSU, but I...
Okay, so I mean, how much have you lost at this point?
Well, at this point, the bank were after me for £339,000. But they were putting compound monthly interest onto that and asking me to pay it monthly. My complaint to the bank was sat on, despite me contacting the bank every month, which was sat on for nigh on 18 months before they dealt with it.
Okay, so did you ever get to the point where you went to the, is it the banking ombudsman or somebody like that? Because obviously it's a little bit much, isn't it? I mean, you can understand Lloyds Bank don't really want to investigate themselves and find themselves guilty.
Exactly, but they... At this point, I didn't think they were guilty. I just thought it was negligence on the part of the bank manager. But the game was not all lost at that stage, because I informed them that the builder was now selling this house for £500,000. And the police had already put a stop for the land transfer on that house. I believe, although I can't say, I believe it would be in anticipation of a claim for proceeds of crime from the bank. They totally ignored that, and they ignored my offer to recover full funds, the full amount of the funds, in preference for making me pay them. So,
One of the most fascinating aspects to your case, David, yeah. I hope you don't mind me calling it fascinating, because it must be horrifying, is discovering that quite a lot of the signatures had been forged, and also that you were not the only person that had discovered that signatures on these documents had been forged.
That is correct. Well, you see, what started off as a matter of negligence that we could have put correctly or put right by simple negotiation turned into criminal offences. And I use that word advisedly, being an ex-criminal investigator. There, what happened was one lie begat another lie, and as the lies escalated, so did the criminality. The demand for the £339,000 came as a formal letter to me, and the signature on it has been deemed by a signature, the bank fraud signature expert, as a forgery, and it now sits as one of 427 criminal charges lodged with the National Crime Agency against the banks in general for forged signatures.
400, did you say?
427 separate charges we've worked on now. I personally came across... Now, we've got to be careful here. I've come across many, many signatures in Lloyds forged, definitely. But by far a bigger number I have come across by other banks, some associated with Lloyds, some building societies, etc. It seems to be the standard thing. One in particular... of one company, not Lloyds, but another company, a mortgage company, I investigated one chap's paperwork that went on over a number of years and ended up in them trying to repossess his home, valued at about 1.4 million. And in the bundle of papers, a large bundle of papers, we discovered a cut and paste signature. It didn't relate to anyone we could identify. It was just a signature that was cut and pasted. It was used by 35 different departments, a total of 135 times, the same signature on documents sent to this guy.
That's a lot of fraud.
But it's stupid.
I mean, I suppose in a way they may have picked on the wrong person, you being a former detective. Do you think that your experience has helped you to deal with this, where others may have been sixes and sevens?
Absolutely. It's had its effect on our family. We had to live six adults. Well, I say adults, I've got teenage boys doing their O-levels, A-levels, HNDs and diplomas, etc., six of us in a holiday caravan for nigh on 2 years as a result of this. We're now in rented accommodation. The property that we were building as a final retirement home is now needing demolition. My wife was obviously under the doctor for depression. I've had one son on suicide watch because of it. My boys lost out on their exams because they couldn't study in the caravan. The knock-on effect, personally, is devastating to any family. I'm aware of at least 16 and possibly 20 people who have either attempted or reported that they would commit suicide as a result of these frauds being perpetrated on them and having lost their properties. You mentioned Trevor Mealham beforehand, great guy. I work very closely with him, have been working with him and helping him with the information for a number of years now. I actually helped him set up his matrix where we're interlocking the connections between people, which takes us back to the Lloyds, to the Lloyds incident in particular. My case went to the ombudsman. I then had a phone call from a bank manager, the same manager who dealt with my complaint, internal complaint, to say to me I was wasting my time with the ombudsman because he'd had a word with them and had it thrown out. I couldn't quite believe this, so I ring the ombudsman, and the ombudsman confirms that having spoken to a manager of Lloyds Bank, senior manager, he has decided that it's not going to be put forward for investigation. I then get a letter to that effect, which the bank then acts upon and says, as the ombudsman has found no wrongdoing on the part of Lloyds Bank, we now can pursue you. It gets deeper than that, because the next thing, my property is fenced off by an LPA receiver. I have a letter from the LPA receiver with two squiggled signatures witnessed by a secretary from a London office. When I send them to the signature forgery expert, he confirms they are both forgeries. So my property was stolen off me by the LPA receiver on forged documents.
Well, it does sound as if we've got an absolute fraud bonanza going on here, and people who feel...
We haven't even touched the surface of this yet.
Well, look, it's worth checking in at this point that Lloyds has also have a track record of this with HBOS. There was a massive fraud and fines for Lloyds Bank during that, wasn't there?
It was massive, yes. Yes, I think what happened was prior to HBOS, they learned some lessons. They then got caught out on the lessons that they hadn't learned in HBOS. And what they've done, this is my opinion only, but I would say that they have slickened up their operation to the point where they've plugged every loophole and they can get away with it wholesale. It seems to me that the loans are not there to make the money. The banks aren't making money from making loans. They are actually making money from the repossessions. I seized my property back. The following day, it was fenced off again. So I ripped their fencing down and put my fencing up. And I told them in no uncertain terms, if they were to turn up on my property, they would be, in my words, cuffed and stuffed and dragged screaming to the police station for acting on fraud knowingly. I haven't heard a thing for 18 months since that point from them.
Well, it sounds almost like this is degenerating not to justice and law and order, but to the law of the jungle.
It is the law of the jungle. It's absolutely the law of the jungle. It's been that way for a long time. In my case, then, I now have possession of my property. So then a firm of vulture lawyers steps in and they take me to court. Now, get this. When we look at the document that they produced in court, it was a loan agreement for a three-way joint loan, me, my wife, and the builder. But I said, well, hang on a minute, my wife and the builder haven't signed the document. And I was sure I hadn't signed it in the presence of the bank manager. So I checked my a copy that I have at home, my original, and it's just got the bank manager's signature on it, nothing else. I then look at the one they produce in the court, and that has got the bank manager's signature on it with the date in her handwriting and my signature with the date in her handwriting under my signature. Now, this is curious. How did this happen? One looks to be a photocopy of the other. So I send this off to a handwriting expert and he says, although they look very similar, they are two separate documents. So now we've been to the county court and they've produced a document which is not the document I signed, purporting that I have signed to take on a loan. Not only that, they have summoned my wife to the same court, even though she's not party to the loan and hasn't signed the document agreeing to the loan, but she is now jointly and severably liable for the entire amount of the loan, bearing in mind the loan money was stolen by somebody who's already been convicted at Crown Court of deceiving Lloyds Bank. But does that stop the lawyers? No, it doesn't. The lawyers are driving the bank. So we escalate it further and I get involved with the Crime Commissioner, brilliant guy, Anthony Stansfeld, fighting our cause. Can't say enough how good about how good he is. He's helping so many people. I think there would be a lot.
I mean, it's interesting because he's also been very critical of the Avon and Somerset Constabulary here Bristol area, isn't he? Because, I mean, this is their patch, and it seems as if you've got one of the biggest criminal fraudulent operations in Castle Park right on Avon and Somerset's doorstep.
Right. Well, yes. Seeing as you say that, because of my position, I have had many, many folders and files and documents sent to me. I have personally found at least 440 suspected forged signatures on bank official documents. I have got a warrant for possession, which they executed to repossess a property, a purported warrant where they got the police and the bailiffs there. When you examine the warrant, the court stamp is on the paper before the details of the warrant. In other words, we have a blank piece of paper with a court stamp on it and the details of the seizure typed in over the top at a later date.
Or else someone has got a time machine. So, I mean, another aspect to all of this, which is emerging at the moment, I mean, this is very much more up to date. This is just January 2021. This year, the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey and the Lloyds boss Antonio Horta Osorio have been facing grillings from MPs over that HBOS scandal many years ago. Andrew Bailey and Antonio Horta Osorio, this is on thisismoney.co.uk website, are facing a grilling from MPs over the aftermath still of the HBOS Reading scandal. So it sounds to me as if we've got something about the M4 corridor here. So Reading is the HBOS and Bristol is the other end of Lloyds and the BSU. So Bailey was chief executive of the Financial Conduct Authority when the fraud was uncovered, and Horta Osorio was boss of HBOS's owner Lloyds, accused of mistreating victims and failing to oversee any adequate compensation scheme. In fact, we've still, I believe, HBOS people waiting to be compensated, even though there's been successful prosecutions of some of these HBOS bosses. The individual victims still haven't got their money back, David.
Correct. That is exactly correct what you say. I have my reservations about looking back at the HBOS. There are people who have not been compensated, and I think as a matter of course they should automatically be so. But the focus now seems to be backwards on something that happened 8-10 years ago or more. I think that is basically designed to divert the attention away from the current epidemic of frauds.
I mean, I understand why you're saying that, but I just think it's fascinating to me how the lack of justice for those victims is still kind of gurgling along in the background with these poor people. And this is what happens, isn't it? When crime is allowed to prosper, as it has been in the case of Lloyds, then really the victims are never going to completely just go away. There's always going to be questions really into the indefinite future. It's like a running sore.
Well, you mentioned Mr. Bailey and you mentioned Mr. Horta Osorio. I wrote personal recorded letters informing them, putting them on formal notice, and 12 board members of Lloyds Bank 2 years ago, putting them on formal notice by recorded letter that there was criminality involved in my case. It was escalating, and if they didn't step in, which is their duty to do so, they would be aiding and abetting further criminality because it was escalating to a massive pitch. This was before I realized there was the scale of things. I had one reply, which just was a nil response to that. 11 out of the 12 never even responded. The crime commissioner, Anthony Stansfeld, wrote to them on my behalf. He wrote to Lord Blackwell stating that this needed sorting out. My MP stepped in and he wrote to Lord Blackwell and to the bank stating there was criminality involved that needed looking at. And to this day, nothing has been done.
OK, so we've had the National Crime Agency, which is touted as the Britain's FBI, as well as, I imagine, other organisations looking into these forgeries of signatures. Has that managed to get anywhere? And who's been looking into that from the official direction?
Well, I've been collating a lot of the crime information and putting it in through to the crime, to the bank signature forgery coordinator, Julian Watts, and he has obviously been submitting it through the correct channels. It's gone in three batches, and the first batch, I think there was 30 or 40 really sound criminal offences, and then there was another batch and another batch. They first went to the Serious Fraud Office. The Serious Fraud Office sat on those crimes, which were all, in my opinion, as a detective, arrestable offences, which were provable. They've sat on those for 15 months until Mr. Stansfield intervened and had them moved from the Serious Fraud Office, who were clearly going to do nothing about it, across to the National Crime Agency. And the National Crime Agency have had them now for several months, and they've been added to, and I believe is now 427 criminal charges involved. I believe that's around about the number that have been compiled professionally and sent in. And to this day, they are making a decision on it, reviewing it.
Well, look, before we hear from Martin Summers, our old Labour Oxford economist about this, or new Labour, I'm not quite sure. We will hear from him in a minute. But it was reported back last year that people have been being arrested in connection with fraudulent applications to the coronavirus bounce back loan scheme. Now, this was touted by Rishi Sunak as a great little scheme to help people rebuild. For example, a lot of money from these schemes was spent in including things like social distancing in restaurants and making alterations in order to allow these places to open. And they've since found, of course, that they're not going to be open. But anyway, what do you make of this BBLS, the bounce back loan scheme?
The bounce back, I don't know a lot about the bounce back loan scheme, but generally my personal opinion about the whole thing about furlough and paying people to stay off work and all, it's, in my opinion, a delayed redundancy. The bigger the debt that the country's in, the bigger the hold that the government have got over the rest of us. And if you look at the rich people, they're getting so much richer at the expense of us. And at the moment, yes, it seems like a holiday. Everybody's having fun and having money at home, although they're restricted. They're getting paid for not going to work. That is going to come to a very abrupt end when the national debt gets to such a point. We'll be paying for it. Not only our grandchildren, but our great-grandchildren will be paying for it. And debt is the hold, in my opinion, that they will have over us for our entire lifetime.
Ian is reporting, has been reporting in November last year, £1 billion of these COVID loan schemes for businesses they believe were just simple frauds. And they were based on a previous loan scheme by the government, which was also defrauded. And so many of the fraudsters have simply jumped on this COVID loan scheme. Mm-hmm. 20 lenders, The Guardian reports, have rejected a total of about 27,000 applications for the bounce back loan schemes from May. But the British Business Bank, which administers the government backed program, said 20 lenders have blocked all these. But they reckon that at least according to this Guardian article, £1 billion of these loans were fraudulent and the government will never see them. In fact, it will be impossible to identify who's actually received the money.
But is it real money? It's debt, isn't it?
It's only debt if it can be traced back to you.
Yeah, but it's coming from somewhere, and we've got to pay it back, haven't we?
The general public will have to pay this back, £1 billion that's been basically stolen by people applying to this, well, fraudsters applying to the COVID loan scheme. Anyway, Martin Summers, we've heard what is there, you know, to 20 minutes or so of a horrendous episode, really, from David down in Cornwall, but it fits into a much kind of bigger picture of a kind of collapse of law and order in the financial sector, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, you mentioned Ian Fraser earlier, who's a financial journalist in Scotland, and he exposed what RBS were doing. Basically, RBS is bankrupt, and what they're doing in order to try and stay afloat is they were basically fraudulently calling in loans that they'd made to small businesses. And as Dave was saying earlier, they're not making money from lending money. They're making money by basically seizing the assets of the businesses that fell into the trap. And the reason they're doing that is because they're basically bankrupt. And what we could have done in 2008 is allow the banking system to collapse, We didn't do that when we're still creating quantitative easing, which is where the money that Dave was mentioning earlier is coming from. But of course, the idea that this is real money that's got to be paid back, it's not. It's quantitative easing money. And if you remember, we started quantitative easing in order to try and prevent the collapse of the financial sector. It was supposed to be an emergency measure going on for a number of months. And here we are over a decade later, and we're still using quantitative easing. And we would still have been using quantitative easing even if there had been no coronavirus. The banking system started to collapse in September of last year in the United States of America. And the Federal Reserve basically intervened massively. They passed a lot of what they do onto BlackRock, which is basically a private organization, is a private finance organization. And they basically decide who gets bailed out, who doesn't get bailed out, and so on. Now, once you've got into this situation, and don't forget the banking system collapsed in Japan at the end of the 1980s, it's not a question of paying money back or not paying it back. They just keep piling this imaginary money into the system to keep the system afloat. And you could argue, if you're going to follow a free market philosophy, that you shouldn't do that and you should just let it collapse. But in practice, of course, nobody really contemplates that, because it ultimately means that everybody, people guilty and innocent, will all lose. I mean, if the banking system collapses, people will lose all the money that they have in the banks. That is how capitalism is supposed to work. But of course, in practice, we never allow capitalism to work like that. But of course, if you're going to bail the banking system out, you've then got to say, well, we're in charge here, not you, us. And of course, a lot of these defrauding small businesses and people like Dave, who are trying to build a retirement home, is a way for them to claw money back so that they can carry on pretending to be solvent. They're not solvent. They've never been solvent. And of course, we've spent an awful lot of time talking about other things, because this is quite complex. And to do anything about it would require a great deal of political will, which certainly isn't there when you realize that the political process in a place like the United States of America is funded by the people who are making all the money. And therefore, there's no pressure whatsoever to stop doing what they're doing in the way that they're doing it. So the COVID pandemic created a perfect opportunity to bail the banking system out and everybody to think that it was to do with COVID. But the system was already collapsing before the COVID crisis came along. And they bailed the banking system out before that under the table. And now, of course, everybody is kind of putting up with this situation because they believe it's to do with COVID. It's to do with the fundamental insolvency, not just illiquidity. They see that what people think is they've got to bail the banks out because they've got to have a certain amount of money just to keep functioning. But they're insolvent. They're not just lacking in cash flow. And this is a fundamental problem all over the world. And, of course, the British financial services sector of the City of London is absolutely integrated into this whole scam. And we've not really been spending a decade discussing this. We spent a decade talking about other things, and we're talking about COVID now. Before that, we were talking about Brexit. There's all sorts of things we've been talking about where we haven't been discussing what's fundamental, the insolvency of the private banking system.
Okay, well, that's why we're talking about it now. What do you make of Martin's analysis, David?
Spot on. I wish I'd met him a while ago. Absolutely spot on. I couldn't have said it better myself. Brilliant.
Can I just add something which I've forgotten? There is, in fact, it is to do with fraud. Peter Galbraith, who's the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous American economist, he's based at Austin, Texas. And he said, if you don't prosecute people involved in financial fraud, then you're giving a green light for them to continue defrauding. So it's not an option add-on. What we've done is we've said, gosh, the system's got into a terrible mess. It's probably just because they've got the wrong ideas. It's not because they've got the wrong ideas. There is deliberate fraud at the heart of this. And in the 1980s, when the savings and loans which were basically like building societies in the United States, collapsed because of fraud, over 1,000 executives were sent to prison. And you can't just fine people who carry out financial fraud, because basically they just regard that as like a parking ticket. And as long as they know how much they're going to be fined, they're making more money from fraud than they're being fined.
Well, the trouble is, Martin, they've got no incentive. Parking ticket that they don't even have to pay themselves.
Well, indeed. And of course, what's often happening is the institutions are being fined. And that's, of course, no threat whatsoever to the people on the inside. They're carrying out a control fraud, basically.
Well, it's
walk
just
away
cost
with money,
it's
what the institution carries the debt.
It's what they call a cost of doing business. And we've seen this exact same thing where people like Pfizer and other vaccine firms, including lots of different companies funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, when they trial their vaccines in Africa, basically using people as guinea pigs, they set aside maybe $30 million basically to bribe officials and to pay compensation if they absolutely have to. But they're not interested in the legal system. They just set aside some money in order to get their vaccines out there. But, I mean, David, what do you think is the extent? I mean, you've spent several years looking at all this fraud that's been going on from Lloyds. And it's interesting what you say is, rather than actually starting to behave themselves after the HBOS scandal, they have used it as an opportunity to learn and hone these fraud techniques. What is the extent of this, do you think, now?
Well, absolutely, you're correct. They've learned from all the previous being caught out. I've been to the APPG for Fairer Banking. I've been to Westminster 7 or 8 times in the last couple of years. And I've made a few assumptions or a few observations. One thing that was stated by the chair of a meeting in Westminster that I attended was that Lloyds, and I'll quote him, have defrauded the public of £100 billion and collectively the UK banks have defrauded the British businesses and public of £1.2 trillion, unquote.
Oh, that's quite a lot of money, Martin.
It is, and I think it's advisable to use the word fraud, because in the 1930s, when Roosevelt took over after the Wall Street collapse, he put in place the Pecora Commission, which essentially sent senior banking executives to prison. Mm. And you have to do that. It's not something that you can avoid and say, well, we'll get the money back, but we won't send them to prison. We've got the fraud has become so fundamental to the modus operandi of the banking system that if you're going to send one person to prison, you'd have to send them all to prison. And because you can't send them all to prison, we can't send anybody to prison. And we're all treating this as if it's normal when it ain't. And of course, when 2008 happened, this program had just really got going. Everybody was saying this is outrageous. We've got to do something about this. What's going on? Something's got to be done. But they basically just put their heads down, were bailed out by the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we've now presumed that somehow capitalism is up and running and everything's functioning. And it's not. And of course, at some point, there's going to be a reckoning. And of course, what will happen is a massive crash, and a lot of these debts will then disappear. Debts that can't be paid won't be paid. Yeah, ultimately, all these debts will disappear, but it will disappear in a cataclysm of destruction of the economy.
Well, I mean, there is another possibility,
lives.
Martin, another possibility, and that is that they'll just keep pumping up the QE ad infinitum.
Well, yes, they can. And all they can do now is exactly what you said, Tony. I mean, basically, they've just said any amount of money, we will print it. And of course, that's why the stock markets, can you believe this? World stock markets are at the highest they've ever been in history, in the middle of a pandemic and an economic collapse. The disjunction between the two things is clearly, enormous. But at a certain point, it will collapse, and it will collapse. And the consequences, of course, this is why they didn't just allow the banks to collapse in the first place, because the consequences are things like World War II, you know, and nuclear weapons and all the rest of it. You move from the economic into the political, societal survival scenario, and it's much bigger than just getting your money back.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's positive this week, and it's fascinating, Ian Fraser, I think, is really a wonderful guy in that he, when we interviewed him many years ago, Martin, he was saying that you cannot trust any of the news in any of the mass media, that is to say the London media, really, or in his case, the Glasgow, Edinburgh media, because all of these financial correspondents rely totally on the Economist, the City of London, to get their information. And so they know that if they start to, lance any boils that are in the financial system, then they simply will either be out of a job or they simply won't get any information. They'll be shut out of that little clique. And so really what we've got is journalists doing public relations for the City of London. So anyway, this week, at least a bit of good news, and this comes from the good old British justice system, amazingly doing the right thing for a change, unlike with Julian Assange and other things, is insurers must pay many small firms for COVID lockdown losses. And I suppose this is cold comfort for those companies that have found that due to the COVID restrictions, they're almost it's impossible to make any money, and so they've gone to their insurance policies, found the right quote, and they phoned up the insurers, and the insurer has, guess what, said, well, actually, no, you're not insured for that, and they've got a big class action together and successfully won. Anyway, tens of thousands of small businesses will receive insurance payouts. Maybe those companies have already gone bust, who knows, but by this point, covering losses from the first national lockdown. The following a court ruling, the Supreme Court found in favour of small firms receiving payments from business interruption insurance policies. For some businesses, it could provide a lifeline. The ruling could cost the insurance sector hundreds of millions of pounds. The Financial Conduct Authority themselves actually brought the test case, with 8 insurers agreeing to take part in proceedings. Well, they agreed. Apparently, these insurers are actually sitting down with the regulator and saying, oh, well, actually, okay, you can prosecute us. But again, it looks to me as if this is the insurance industry doing deals in order to pay the minimum amount possible for policies that they're simply refusing to pay out on. And so, again, this is looking to me as if there's a lot of fraud. But anyway, it's at least for some people, this is good news, David, isn't it?
It's good news for some people, but you've got to look at the bigger picture. I mean, you mentioned regulators there. Now, we've obviously been through the mill for 5 or 6 years to different regulators. And during those times, I've been working with Trevor Mealham, as you mentioned earlier, and we've put together a matrix of connections. Now, you may or may not be shocked to find out that, for instance, the financial ombudsman, I have a list of over 40 ex-financial ombudsmen who either are or were Lloyds bank managers. Now, you've got the fox looking after the chicken coop here, haven't you? And then you move up to the FCA. The FCA is just full of bankers. And when we plotted a matrix, bit like an underground map, really, of who's connected to who, we find that people very influential in the City of London banking are also sitting on boards such as the City of London Police Authority, the Action Fraud Authority, the Financial Conduct, or the Financial Ombudsman Service, the Serious Fraud Office and National Crime Agency. And when you look, there's a whole network of connections between them all.
But as an ex-policeman yourself, I mean, this starts to look as if it may actually be an organised criminal network.
Yes, it is by definition organised criminal network, although they won't accept it. But you see, you have the fundamental problem that we're finding is... for instance, we'll take Anthony Stansfield, who we mentioned before, and I'm sure he won't mind me because I've been to his police force before and we've had lots of discussions on it. His investigation into the HBOS, which ended up in about 6 or 7 people being locked up, that's all, cost his police force out of his policing budget something of the order of £7 million. Okay? Now, that's a massive chunk out of a local policing budget. Now, out of that, he only received about £2 million back. So he's £5 million out of pocket. But the fine, now I'm not sure on the figure, but I think it was £42 million, went straight to the Treasury. And if you look back over history, you've got banks such as HSBC funding drug cartels in South Africa many, many years ago, who got fined £1 billion. Now, that money went to the Treasury. Now, the Treasury is the ultimate policeman for banking conduct. So as long as the Treasury is making billions of pounds out of not policing the banks, why would they police them?
Well, yeah, good question. I think the most important, maybe one of the kingpins in this network, is a chap called Andrew Bailey. Now, he's now Bank of England governor. He oversaw the disastrous HBOS. I mean, how much confidence can we have in him as now Bank of England governor? When he was at the Financial Conduct Authority, he oversaw the disaster of HBOS.
Personally, I have zero confidence in him from a matter of... What I've been investigating has been down the line of Lloyds, and then obviously I can't say no to helping other people. I'm afraid that does get in the way, and I've actually put my stuff on the back burner to help some other people who are more in deeper mess than we are. But eventually I'll get round to it. But because of what I'm doing, people are sending me stuff, and the information I'm having in is that Mr. Bailey knew all along what was going on. And I now have information about so many other things that have not been investigated by the FCA. And again, the FCA is bankers, and bankers are through the FOS and the FCA. It's all run by bankers. And if you look at our matrix that we created, like the underground map, you can see who is connected to who. And it is just, it looks like a very well-organized crime network. And I can say it quite honestly, crime is being suppressed by the regulators. They are not investigating anything we put to them. And I've tested this out because I've had two or three other people's cases. I've tried to report to different police force areas. Now, there are 43 police force areas in this country, and every one of them, if it's got the minuscule hint of fraud, it automatically tells you you must report it to Action Fraud. We prefer to call it Action Less Fraud, but Action Fraud. Now, Action Fraud is a call centre in Scotland run by the City of London Police Authority. And I've already stated that bankers sit on the London Police Authority. So what we've got is every single financial fraud that you report in this country gets funneled one way or another. And I've tried it with 5, 6 or 7 different police forces in every way, by trying to do it by email, on the phone. And it always comes back to, you need to report it to Action Fraud. And Action Fraud do absolutely nothing about frauds. Now, there's a very, very clever gentleman working with us who's an ex-City investment I think stockbroker investment banker. He has put together a report about what the wrongdoing is Lloyds is, and many experts have looked at this, and they said the bubbling under of what's bubbling under the surface of going on in the bank in this country is way bigger than Watergate. And I would agree with it is far bigger than the Watergate scandal ever was.
Okay, so why do you say that?
Why? The corruption that we're finding. You can't report any fraud. You can't report it to anybody other than Action Fraud. And about 2% maximum of what's reported to them ever gets investigated. I've looked at other people's praises of their cases. And then I've looked at the evidence of one or two. And they are blatant criminal offences. If I was still serving, I would be knocking on their door with a team and seizing their... I'd be going around to the banks. I'd be seizing all the paperwork. I'd be making arrests on a tenth of the evidence on some of these cases. I would be making arrests day after day after day.
I mean, if as you say, fraud isn't being prosecuted, why would anybody want to set up and run an honest business?
Exactly. Well, the public are kept in the dark. We are the cash cow. The public are the cash cow. What they'll do is they'll encourage you to set up a business. They will overvalue everything and give you massive loans and et cetera. By the way, banks don't lend money. It's securitized, but that's another story. They will facilitate you getting hold of some money from investors, shall we say. That's the easy way of putting that. Then later on, they'll come around and they will reevaluate the matter, and they'll say, well, you're very, very overvalued here, and then they will go after your property. The banks are not interested in lending money. That's not where they make their money. They make their money out of repossessing property from innocent people. Small and medium enterprises. Again, a quote from the APP chair of banking, Better Banking, sat in a room full of about 40 MPs. I was there to give evidence. And he stated that some 60,000 businesses had gone under since HBOS as a result of being defrauded of their property.
MP Kevin Hollenrake is the chair of APPG, which is a parliamentary group, and he said it's unacceptable that 4 years after the criminal convictions, we're still fighting tooth and nail to get any justice for the victims. I mean, this is really okay. So, as a former detective yourself, I mean, I'm sure you've thought about if it is actually possible to round people up, put people who are criminals behind bars. Is there any hope, do you think, that we might actually put an end to this continued and systematic fraud conspiracy?
Well, it goes back again to whether the Treasury Select Committee and the Treasury will actually do the right thing, because simply, when you've got the fox looking after the hen house, you're not likely to get any justice there. You're just not going to get it. What you need is to do away with the FCA. That's a total and utter waste of time from what we've seen. There's more frauds going on than you can imagine. The FCA is a total and utter non-entity. The Financial Ombudsman Service, that is a total joke. It is not worth the paper it's written on. And I have thousands of people who will back me up on that. It's just literally a waste of time going there. And they're getting paid good money to do absolutely nothing for the public. They're working for the banks. They're putting everything towards the banks. And until we get some people banged up for a long time for criminal offences, we need somebody to stand up and do it. What we need is an independent inspector of banking. Somebody at the top who says, that's wrong, we're going to investigate it, send a team in, seize everything and investigate it properly. It's doable. But every time we get to anywhere near that, and we did get very near that, I went to Westminster and we had a meeting of very, very senior police, retired police, clever minds. And we were sat there and we came up with a plan and it was scuppered. We cannot get justice. It's as simple as that. And as an ex-policeman, it really does upset me, the fact that when I joined up to help people against unfair regimes. And what we have here is we have the banks more or less as a financial dictatorship to the rest of the country. They are telling the police, they are telling everybody what to do, and they actually say they are too big to fail.
Well, maybe too big to jail as well. Do you think they are too big to jail?
It depends on what support you have. You see, there's who prosecutes the prosecutors. You see, if you go to the top and they're all corrupt, how do you get anything past the judges, for instance? You know, I mean, we've constantly produced evidence at court, personally myself as well, to show that documents are forged, and literally the judges are saying a quote, it's of no merit, unquote. That seems.
I mean, it's not just financial crime that's in trouble, is it? Because we had a report from the BBC this week from Dominic Cacciani, bless him, the Home Affairs correspondent.
Yeah.
COVID and the courts, grave concerns for justice, warned watchdogs.
Yeah.
And they've got a funny little sketch here of a courtroom with everyone wearing masks. Well, when I've been into cover court cases over the last few months, I haven't seen any masks being worn, certainly by judges and by the senior staff there. And in fact, they've even said, oh, you can take your masks off if you want to people when they're arriving in court to observe it. But former criminal justice watchdogs for England and Wales have warned they have grave concern about the impact of court backlogs caused by the pandemic, in inverted commas. This inspectorates for policing, prisons, probation and prosecutors say issues it has caused could damage the criminal justice system for years. It comes after figures revealing the banking backlog of the Crown Courts has reached 54,000 unheard cases. That means some crimes from last year will not go before a jury before possibly 2022. Now, many of those people are out on bail, no doubt. And apart from Julian Assange, who's an innocent man, who's being kept in Belmarsh prison, bizarrely, and a totally perversion of justice. But Martin, I mean, this is does give the impression that organised crime is kind of running the show, really. That they are laughing because they're not even having to go. They can say, oh, well, I'm not coming to court because I've got a symptom of COVID or something like that. And in the meantime, these court cases are simply not going on. And the other aspect is organised crime is doing extremely well out of this pandemic. We're in a situation now where there's lots and lots of basic services and goods which you cannot get hold of. Organised crime steps into the gap and provides them at high profit margins, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, there's profiteering that that goes on, if you like, in any situation of extremity like this, like in wartime or anything like or anything else. The coming back to the financial services sector, there is systematic criminality. And from an economics point of view, if you allow people to make money through fraud and you do not punish it, then that creates a bottom line that even honest people who don't want to try and make money through fraud, their bonuses or whatever are going to depend upon competing with people who do. And that's why you should or you ought to deal with fraud in a robust fashion, because otherwise the system as a whole becomes corrupted. Now, that's where we're at, because we haven't done anything. We should have done stuff after 2008, but we didn't. And now we're paying the consequences. Yeah,
so did
every
Karl level. Marx predict all of this, the end of capitalism?
Well, no, because Karl Marx talked about the falling rate of profit as a result of technological change in a kind of model of capitalism. He said it's just a model. Let's just leave fraud out of it. So if you read volume one of Capital, Marx says, well, we all know fraud goes on. But I'm going to discuss something more fundamental than fraud about what makes capitalism, potentially an unstable system. And that, in other words, Marxist analysis historically has been rather weak on the analysis of fraud, because it said that fraud isn't really the main problem. Now, fraud shouldn't be the main problem. You're going to get fraud and corruption in any system, but as long as the system's robust, then it's not going to affect the viability of the system.
Let me ask you the same question I asked to David Leighty, who's on the line from Cornwall, former police officer and victim of Lloyds Bank. Martin, do you think there's any solution? Is it feasible that these people will be brought to book?
I think that is the solution. This is what Galbraith is saying. And of course, other and this is his particular area of expertise, is financial fraud. And of course, financial fraud has economic effects. It's obviously a disaster for the people who get defrauded and so on. But it has economic effects. I mean, Michael Hudson's very good on this in the US as well. If you allow fraud to run the financial services sector, ultimately, you're sawing off the branch you're sitting on. Because ultimately the real economy is being parasited by these non-productive activities. And if you allow non-productive activity like fraud to take over your system, then ultimately if all the small businesses go bust because they're being defrauded, then they're not producing anything. And then, of course, you've got problems with efficient demand. Is there enough demand in the economy to pay everybody and so on? These issues are fundamental now, but I think a key to it is not just that, if you read the mainstream press, there's a kind of critical, you do find critical voices saying that the ideology of the free market is what the issue is. And of course, a lot of the problem is that even people who are well-meaning have this kind of you know, basically ideological view of the world that people making money is a good thing, and therefore it, how they make it isn't much of an issue. And anybody who questions this is some kind of leveling communist who doesn't understand how the system works. And of course, they make it as kind of, you know, you can imagine these guys like the governor of the Bank of England make it all sound so complicated that ordinary people couldn't possibly understand what's at stake and so on. But I think what you really need is a political change of attitude that we can and we must deal with this. And that's precisely what did happen in the United States in the 1930s with the Pecora Commission. Basically, he was exactly like this independent banking inspector that Dave was suggesting. And he dragged all of the top people in front of him, and many of them were sent to prison to great cheers from the population. But of course, you can imagine that the bankers aren't very happy about that kind of prospect, and they've got every interest in preventing it from happening, and they've got allies at every level, because who ultimately are the beneficiaries of all this fraud? Well, it's the shareholders in the banks, and they are the wealthy people who have basically, you know, infest the top levels of the political structure.
Yeah, well,
it's going to be difficult.
We've had a fascinating news story this week, which is this idea of paying people £500 if they test positive, which I think it's incredible to think. Of course, you've got lots and lots of people out there who've got no money at all, not even to pay the rent. They may be about to be evicted as soon as the lockdown ends. And then they're told, if you can test positive, there's £500 for you. Well, you know, what are you going to do? You might even find people desperately trying to get COVID in order to get their £500. Amazing news story. David Leite, what do you make of when you heard that?
Well, it's verging on criminal coercion, is it not? It's sort of tempting people to commit all sorts of possible crimes. I mean, it's easy to find a positive test and duplicate it over and over again with different names. It opens itself to all sorts of frauds again.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, one of the things this throws into clear focus for me is that our society should be making sure that people have the basics of life, that is to say food, water, shelter, these basic things, so they don't need to get thrown into these ridiculous situations, either with organised criminals having to go around committing crime in order to just make a few bob to pay the rent, and this sort of thing. So I think the government really needs to look, everybody needs to look at reinsuring these basic things that we all need to live, that we get. Otherwise, really, we're on a road to nowhere. The other thing I'd like to, just before we hear a kind of closing comments from David Leite in Cornwall, is Boris's beach blonde. This is from a while ago, but it's interesting about Carrie Simmons, Boris's so-called girlfriend, her X-rated play. The glamorous PR guru Carrie Simmons starred in a satanic sex cult based on writings of an unabashed occultist, that is, I'm afraid, Aleister Crowley, the Satanist of the 1930s. Carrie Simmons' social media posts show her in a variety of what they call in the Daily Mail glamorous poses. One of the photographs shows her holding a watermelon whilst on holiday in a certain place. Others show her at the helm of a yacht, and another drinking glasses of rosé wine. And a shocking image comes from an X-rated play which she performed at Warwick University. In that picture of the play is a very clear satanic symbol of some kind. Now, you do wonder who this woman is, who is, I mean, she's not committed herself to our Prime Minister Boris Johnson, but she's obviously got a lot of influence over him, David.
Well, she has, yes. I mean, you're going off onto another subject that I'm involved in as well. I'm involved in many things because of the banking thing. It crosses over into all sorts of other things, because everything that happens on this planet, shall we say, without mentioning too much detail, everything revolves around money. I mean, you know, moving stuff around the world, whether it's people, stuff, products or anything, it involves transfer of money. And you need, if you're doing something dodgy, you need a dodgy transfer of money. Need I say more? It's all connected. It's all connected with the finance.
Yeah, so she's a big fan of Aleister Crowley, Martin. Are you?
Well, Tony, I mean, I'm not going to go down this road. We've just been talking about the macroeconomics of financial fraud, and now we're talking about whether Carrie Symons is a follower of Aleister Crowley. It's a bit of a non sequitur from my point of view. I haven't got an opinion on it.
Okay, so I think it is quite important, particularly since she's not actually married or committed to Boris. And I mean, I think it's quite, you know, interesting to see the way that Boris has seems to be a very sort of controlled opposition style. I mean, the only actual opposition to these COVID lockdown policies is from within his own party. But he's certainly a very weak prime minister. I don't think anyone would say that. Every week he promises something. The next week he says, I'm very sorry, I'm going to have to tear up that promise, and you're going to have to be locked down for another God knows how many months. It actually seems as if we've got these Gates-funded, Foundation-funded, Imperial College people on SAGE and on what's the other advisory group? Oh, gosh. Nerve tag, that's right, running the show. Boris is just put in front of, given a script, put in front of a TV camera and told what to do. And it's certainly not healthy that he appears to have this satanic influence sitting in Downing Street with him. Anyway, David, let's let you sum up and see what you would like to say about the, you know, your own situation and also the situation the country's in now with the almost permanent lockdowns.
Well, firstly, my own situation, if they'd have listened to me in the first place, I wouldn't be here now. I'd have been quite happily settled up and sorted out with them. But they've dug a bigger and bigger hole. I have enough information now to go and arrest a number of very, very senior bank managers and board members. I have enough information to arrest them on under the old school that I used to work in. Unfortunately, that will not be backed up by the current regime because it's so corrupted all the way up through that I wouldn't get past go, even though the evidence is there. What we need is an independent banking regulator to look at these people, not a financial conduct authority or a financial ombudsman service that is absolutely full of bankers and ex-bankers or influenced by the city. We need a totally independent setup for that. And until that happens, and until many senior bankers are arrested and put in jail to make an example of, I don't think anything's going to change. The only change you will see is they'll get cleverer and cleverer at closing up the loopholes, which they've done since the HBOS scandal. What was the other question? Sorry.
Well, I just want you to just sort of sum up your thoughts about the way the country is being run, and particularly around COVID lockdowns, because it does seem as if we've got a situation now we're being constantly promised and dangled in front of our noses ever since March last year that in a few months' time everything will be fine, and of course once those few months roll round, it's not going to be fine. And in fact, I think most people now are really fed up with all of this out there. And they're saying, well, we need you as a government to have a plan to return to normal. And we want it now.
But I don't think we've got a government. We've got a dictatorship, because if there's no law to that, if we're not in agreement with what's going on and the law isn't there to do it, to back it up, then we're under a dictatorship. I mean, we were locked down in this last lockdown without any legislation in place to cover it. That is, by definition, dictatorship. We're under a police state where the police are enforcing rules and regulations that are not actual law. Basically, this isn't going to end. I mean, if you know where to look and you know where to find the evidence, hard evidence, the last lockdown is scheduled to finish in April 2025. It's already been agreed. It was already discussed in 2010 in a presidential suite in a USA hotel by certain people who are in the fore now. It was discussed then. It was planned. This has been planned for years, and it won't end until 2025.
But okay, then planned. Hang on, David. Planned by who?
Planned by the very people that are implementing it.
Who are we talking about?
People need to do research, and I'm not going to make any names on the air now, but the research is there to show who attended what meetings. And the people that you see in the popular press now who are saying we should be doing this, that and the other from abroad, It's a plan. It's a depopulation plan of the world. It's there's no two ways about it. It's to if you go back to the 1954 Bilderberg meeting, the very first one, the agenda was we will exchange worthless paper for all the land on the planet. And that's basically what they're doing, promissory notes. That's what's happening.
Do you think this is about land too?
It's about property grab. It's about depopulation and property accumulation. Simple.
And debt, I suppose, plunging people into debt. What's the point of that?
Debt. Ah, you see, people think people are controlled with money. Now, I think I might have mentioned this to you or somebody before. If I had £1 million and you had a pound in your pocket and I told you, oh, run along there and do this errand for me, you could tell me where to go because you don't, you know, you're not beholden to me, even though I've got £1 million and you've only got a pound. And it might be the last pound in your life. But if I've got a pound and you owe me £10,000, you're going to do what I ask you to do, or else I'm going to make it very difficult when it comes to paying back that £10,000. I'm going to want it now. So on that analogy, it's not the money that controls people. The money is the penultimate step in the control. The final control comes when you get people into debt. And once they're in debt, they're beholden to you or the creditor so that you will make them do more or less what you want to get out of that debt.
Now, so, now Rishi Sunak, one of the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he's from Goldman Sachs, another Bilderberg outfit. And, you know, I've met several of these people. They are rather withering, strange characters. Rishi obviously has been through some sort of PR process to try and make him palatable to the public. But, I mean, he's actually driving the country into debt now, isn't he, even further?
What better to do than to control the country? Look, if we didn't have any debt, what would they be able to make us do? They couldn't put the taxes up. They couldn't insist we pay tax on fuel and VAT. They couldn't increase VAT to 25%, for example. How could they do that? They couldn't. But if you're in debt, the narrative is we have to reduce the debt. We're going to have to increase taxes. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can control people who are indebted to you. You can't control people just because you've got more money than them, only to a certain degree. But you have total control if you have total debt control.
Finally, I'm thinking of Trevor Mealham there, because I'm used to chatting with him, David. Finally, yeah. David, where can people follow some of your work, either online or social media?
On social media, we've got two private. We've had to make them private now because we've had so many takedowns and we're being censored left, right and center. So we've made them private. There's a Facebook group called Action for Justice / Lloyd's Victims. And there's also the Action for Justice community. But I am in the process now. I've had a terrible job getting some domain names launched because they said that I might be saying things I shouldn't say and they're censoring me. So I've now managed to have my website rebuilt abroad out of the reach of, shall we say, the people who don't like to hear what I'm saying. And that will be launched in about a week. And that is called theinsolatus.tv. Insolatus.tv.
You better spell that for us.
insolatus.tv.
What does that mean?
Insolatus is the Latin word for extraordinary, weird, unusual, uncommon. So it covers everything that's going on at the moment.
And now you also mentioned your and Trevor's Matrix. This is obviously a fantastic, useful research tool for anyone who's trying to track these criminals and bring them to justice. Is that available anywhere?
What we did, I taught Trevor about making a murder board because it's probably easier for you to for listeners to visualize a murder board. On a detective show you'll see on television, they'll put photographs and car registrations and things on a big board on the wall, and then they take string and ribbon from one to the other, and it looks like a roadmap at the end of the day. Well, we started doing that with a sheet of A3 paper, but by the end of the week it became a 14-foot dining table. It is now 3.5 meters by 2 meters and involves everybody from ex-chancellors all the way to the Bank of England and to the FCA and the Common Purpose Movement. They're all involved. And there are absolutely substantiated links between all of these people. We've looked at it and we've been told it's bigger than Watergate, as I said before. What we've done is we've published a portion of it to let them know, and we've even given the people involved a copy of it. 150 or 60 versions, bound copies of it, have gone out. Not one murmur has come back. Not one threat of legal action, nothing, which tells me we must be doing something right. We can publish this. I can get you a copy and you can do what you like with the copy of the portion. Even the portion that we are releasing is devastating. It's an eye opener, but it will give you an insight into what we've had, what the investigation has found so far. Bearing in mind, it's probably only 20% of what we know. And if I was on the wrong end of it, I'd be looking to move out to a neutral country by now. Knowing what I know. Now,
well, I mean, some of the kingpins, do you think they're names that we would recognise? Or, I mean, I'm used to following the Bilderbergers over the years, and it's fascinating to see some of the most powerful people and the wealthiest in the world very, very much shy away from any kind of publicity. So they're names that most people wouldn't know.
Some of these people, they're high-profile people, but people wouldn't think that they're involved in it. And we've got everything from bankers, crime commissioners, regulators, judges, everything you can imagine, everything in the establishment, as what you would understand as the establishment. There isn't one element of the establishment that is not involved, from what I can see. And on some of these individuals, I would have been looking at making a total career out of dealing with just one of those in the old days of policing. Just one of these kingpins would have made me a totally successful career, let alone the combination. But as I say, when the regulators go wrong, who regulates the regulators?
Well, it's a fascinating way to leave it. David Leite, former police detective, speaking from Cornwall, thanks very much for joining us. And we'll be hearing in a minute more about COVID and some other stories from around the world, as well as a special look at eugenics and the documentary The New Normal, which is out this week. A fantastic documentary. It should be shown on the BBC, but of course it won't be, because the BBC censors this sort of material these days, just like the old sort of Soviet style censorship that we've got now going on here in the UK. And before that, though, we're going to hear some music. So thanks very much, David Leite from Cornwall, and Martin. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Thank you.
Mass awakening. Listen close.
Probably put me in my grave for the lyrics I spit. Been exposing the truth and all the secrets they covering. If I die, it was big pharma or government. Been putting too much truth in my songs. That they gon' stage a suicide and say I chose to move on. Probably cutting my brakes, so when I tour too long, I'll die in a crash, say I was driving and drunk. Look, the Illuminati real. They're trying to make you dumb, trying to numb you out with pills. Trying to make you broke, trying to tell you it's a deal. Processing your food, so now none of it is real. You eating super good, but you still be getting ill. You working super hard, but you still can't pay the bills. Silencing the visionaries, revising the dictionaries. Now you just can't find the right words to say and express how you feel. Target on my back, I think they're coming for my head. I know I recognize that man. I bet they wanna see me dead. They're gonna kill me if I leave my room. They're gonna kill me if I go too soon. You should know. Said they would kill me. I admit it, I'm afraid they gon' murder me. Wouldn't be a problem if nobody ever heard of me. But I'm famous, so they'll probably try erasing me with urgency. Infect me with a sickness and deny me any surgery. Stop me from exposing all the medicine and currency and terrorism. Always been controlling us so perfectly. I'm telling you with certainty, they say it's for security. They monitor our lives like we live in Nazi Germany. They wanna microchip all the people, you don't believe it. Your fingerprints unlocking your phone, oh how convenient. They trick you to believe in all the angels and demons, and say you'll go to hell if you ever go disappoint Jesus. I got a backbone and a platform and a tap phone. Never asked for to be that known. Take my passport to my dad. Use the back door to escape this place. It's a Truman Show.
Target on my back, I think they're coming for my head. I know I recognize that pen, I bet they wanna see me dead. They're gonna kill me if I leave my room. They're gonna kill me if I go too soon. You should know, I said they would kill me.
I admit
me.
It, I'm afraid I'll disappear. They won't issue me a ticket for a minor misdemeanor. They gon' try to lock me up before the moment when I'm here. Just let me take a minute to make sure you see it clear. Cancer has a cure, they killed Biggie and Pop. One thing I know for sure, 9/11 was an inside job. They stamped dollar bills within God we trust. Well, a single dollar bill, the only thing we got. I think they probably think they got us fooled. Distort the information in curriculums at school. They ain't making you a scholar, man, they're making you a fool. They're making you a felon if you choose to break the rules. They designed a game with a million ways to lose. Not a single way to win. Only option you can choose is to play it with a grin, or you play it feeling blue. Either way the wheels spin, you won't ever make a move. They gon' kill me for this.
Target on my back, I think they're coming for my head. I know I recognize that man, I bet they wanna see me dead. They're gonna kill me if I leave my room. They're gonna kill me if I go too soon. You should know, said they would kill me.
Hey babe, I just walked in the house. Did you leave the door open by chance? I don't know, the door was open. No, I just walked up and the door was like open a crack. Yo, fuck, they're in the house! Babe!
Get on my back, I think they're coming for my head. I know I recognize that then, I bet they wanna see me dead. They're gonna kill me if I leave my room. They're gonna kill me if I go too soon. You should know, said they would kill me.
Well, I wish I could tell you what that who'd done that, but I couldn't. I just was sent it. It's called Music is it's called Mass Awakening. Obviously, very recently produced. If anyone's got the artist and some sort of reference for who it was, who it is, then do please email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk, or you can leave a comment on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. UK. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We'll be looking in this hour a little bit more at some particularly The New Normal, the documentary out this week that should be on TV but isn't. What's in the documentary and why is it not on TV? And looking at the century of the lie in the way the 21st century opposing views to the official story have been banned, 9/11, climate change, terrorist attacks. Actually, the BBC formally saying that people who are opposed to climate change are simply not going to be discussed or given any kind of say on the BBC at all. Now, that's not journalism. That's censorship. They're admitting it themselves. Lockdowns, which some say are killing more than COVID. That view, however, is banned. You know, that, just what I've just said, that they're killing more than COVID. It's banned. Instead, we have paid government radio ads saying 1/3 of Britons have COVID and are spreading it. And outside, I mean, I heard one of those just this morning, which I just don't believe at all. 1/3 of Britons have COVID. And just as the World Health Organization this week has been talking about the PCR tests being unreliable on their own and that governments shouldn't be using them. Well, that's what we're using. In fact, you can't fly abroad if you haven't got a negative PCR test. But the World Health Organization says they're unreliable and they cannot be used on their own. If you break the rules, people will die. Another official government radio ad, complete and utter nonsense. You people will die if you break the rules. Well, they might die, but you're saying they will die. So you're lying, government, on your radio ads, aren't you? The massacre of journalism in the UK we're discussing tonight. Also about a BBC 1926 PSYOP broadcasting from the barricades, produced and presented by a guy called Ronald Knox, before Orson Welles, as he put out a BBC broadcast which was designed to shock the nation by pretending that the Houses of Parliament had been burnt down by an angry mob in London. And because it was in the middle of winter and there was snow, many parts of the country had no newspapers. And so they believed that this was all true, a kind of shock doctrine technique, a way of using broadcasting done by the BBC Ronald Knox, the presenter and producer of that program, back in 1926. The cruelty of the carers. We look at the care home scandal revisited, a great ITV documentary last night looking at the failures of care homes to care for residents and the suicide of a care home manager. The loving daughter and granddaughter that managed to prise their elderly mum out of a care home only for them to be arrested. They weren't caring for her. And also the documentary goes and chats to them today with their grandma back, their nan back at home. The RT-PCR test, as I said, is not being allowed or is being condemned, really, by the World Health Organization. Also, Martin, we'll be talking finally about eugenics, the Bill Gates family tradition. A new look at the spiffing British chap called Charles Galton Darwin, grandson of Charles Darwin. The techniques he suggested in his 1952 book, The Next Million Years, for getting rid of not just the family, but men's desire to procreate using drugs, leaving society with the help of these chemicals and a vast pool of fertile women for the elite to procreate with. As he says, one king, literally the father of his country. And so, Martin Summers, well, before we get into all that stuff for our part two, I know you've had a horrendous time yourself actually trying to claim what is rightfully your proper compensation through your car insurance, having your car broken into. Now, it's no slight on you to say that your car is not exactly some sort of, you know, mega sports car that is worth lots of money that people would really want to hotwire and drive around. There's much more expensive cars than yours around, so it's a little bit suspicious that anyone would want to try and hotwire your motor. There's certainly nothing valuable sitting there inside they try and want to get into. But you've had a real time, haven't you, actually trying to get proper, like, for example, on your insurance, a replacement car, for example.
Well, it's obviously been an annoying thing from my point of view. Earlier in the week, on Monday morning, I went out to drive off to work to find that somebody had tried to break into the car, tried to hotwire it and failed. And I imagine it was probably kids because, as you say, nobody's going to steal my car for it's not worth a lot. But of course, it's very inconvenient for me that it doesn't work. I've had to go to work on the bus all week, which has been a bit of a pain. And of course, the AA, I phoned the AA and I wanted them to, you know, basically come and get it started. But they said, no, we're not going to do that because it's been hotwired. You know, our patrols won't do that. But what we will, and I'm insured via the AA. So they said, but what we'll do is we'll arrange for it to be potentially fixed, and we'll send you a document with the garage that we'll use, and we'll send you the telephone number of that garage, and they will contact you in due course to arrange picking it up and trying to fix
it. Well, I would have thought it was actually their job to contact the garage.
It is their job to contact the garage.
Pick up your car.
It is their job to contact the garage. I have contacted the garage several times, and they've been quite helpful and said, well, as soon as the AA tell us, you know, we do this all the time for them, and when we get the stuff through, we will do it. But what was said to me by the people at the AA on the telephone, and also by the garage, is that all of this stuff is taking a lot longer at the moment because they haven't got full staff in the office and so on. So I was rather hoping that it would be sorted quickly so I could get it back on. And because, of course, if they're fixing it, they give me a complimentary car. But while they're not fixing it, they don't. And of course, they may just decide to write it off, and I'll get a fraction of what I paid just to have it MOT'd last year as compensation. But in any case, it's just a massive inconvenience. But there you are. And of course, it's been added to by the problem that we've had, with the fact that people aren't all in the office and they're not everything's being slowed down.
I can't help, but I mean, I think you know, you, Martin, have actually been caught between the devil and the deep blue sea here.
Yeah, well, it's just been inconvenient. It's not the end of the world, you know. I can get to work on the bus. It's just I'm going to have to sort something out about the car. But
yeah, but I mean,
it's not really earth shattering.
It seems to me, it's just another example of companies like the AA using COVID as an excuse simply not to deliver on their insurance. Of course, they're saving lots of money not providing you with a car this week.
Well, no, I think in actual fact, what it does show, because the AA a couple of years ago sold me a battery to fix a battery that had gone died on me, and it turned out that it was not a really suitable battery. I think what's happened with the AA is that they've basically become, they're a very big organization, and, you know, working through a big organization, you know, that's been my strategy all along, is if they're a big organization, then they're likely to know what they're doing. But precisely because they're big, they're also careless and sloppy, and they can get away with stuff, so they do. And especially if you're a minor player like me, you know, that you're just, you know, that you're no priority.
Well, that's no good, because so how are you managing to get to work and back every day now?
Well, I told you, I'm on the bus, but it's very inconvenient because it's quite a long way. You know, with the car, it was quite easy to get there. The bus, it's a pain. And of course, it's actually using buses at the moment is more problematic. There's less of them. You're not guaranteed to be able to get on, and so on. I mean, it's just hassle. But then there you are. It's not just, you know, the situation is not just bad for me.
Yeah, I mean, you've paid your money. You've paid your money for your AA coverage and your insurance, and you've got nothing whatsoever in return. Anyway, we'll keep a track of this, Martin, and, you know, hopefully
I'm not going to break my heart over it. It's just stuff.
It breaks my heart that you have been, you know, you went in your hour of need. That's why people take out insurance, is so that in your hour of need, there's another vehicle, and you can go and see your parents if you needed to. You can do whatever it is you need.
Yeah, well, when you mentioned earlier, Tony,
they haven't delivered, have they?
Well, when you mentioned earlier, Tony, about the success that people have had in suing the insurance companies because they weren't paying out over their businesses being closed due to lockdown and COVID, that's a success for the small guy, if you like. But on the other hand, of course, the money also is lost to the insurance companies, and the insurance companies and the banks are insolvent. And this is what underlies everything. And at some point, they're going to collapse. And so all the money that's been paid into them by people expecting something out of them is going to disappear, and everybody's going to be left holding the baby. And that's more fundamental, because ultimately the system as a whole is unsustainable. And if you can shuffle around, everybody cheered, for example, a few years ago when the Icelanders refused to pay out people who'd had foreigners who'd had bank accounts in Iceland were not given compensation by the Icelandic government. But because the two banks in Iceland were basically based in the city of London, the British taxpayer had to bail out the British people who'd lost money in the Icelandic banks. That money ultimately goes onto the British national debt. So even when you win a court case and you shuffle the paper around, ultimately the debt goes to somebody else. What we've got now is privatization of profits and socialization of losses, which means that basically the asset owning classes are made whole at the expense of the non-asset owning classes. And that is ultimately unsustainable. It's sustainable in the short run because it's a system of exploitation anyway. But ultimately, of course, it's unsustainable. And there will be, you know, the system then implodes and is reconfigured, as we saw at the end of the 1930s with the Second World War. And we're now seeing with China taking over in Southeast Asia because their economy is going to boom next year, while the British economy and the US economy are going to go down the drain. And this is because what's underlying all of this is competition between social systems. And that's more fundamental, really, than anything else.
Martin, if there's anything really urgent, just give me a bell and I'll take you in my motor. It's just, I think, appalling that you haven't got your courtesy car. Keep banging on to them about that. But anyway, we've got a big story today. I think this one was this morning, in fact, last night. And it's from a few days ago, but it takes a while for the police to report these things to the press. A wedding party in Stamford Hill is broken up by police. This is an Orthodox Jewish girls' school where they said about 150 people. Other reports are saying 400 people had gathered for a wedding, a Jewish girls' school in Stamford Hill. They arrived on Thursday, actually, so it's last night at 9:15 in the evening. guests fled from the Orthodox Charedi Jewish school. When the police arrived, the organisers faced £10,000 fine, possibly, for breaking the lockdown rules. The Met originally claimed that 400 guests were at the gathering. In a statement, the school said the hall had been leased out. A spokesman for the school, whose principal rabbi, Avraham Pinter, died in April after contracting coronavirus, said, "We had no knowledge that the wedding was taking place." Well, that sounds a bit difficult to believe. But Martin, this does raise quite an important point, isn't it? That this is a religious gathering here. And surely there should be some kind of understanding by the authorities that they shouldn't be stopping legitimate religious rights of people here.
Well, I mean, we're talking now about the rights and wrongs of having a lockdown, whether this is a wedding. And of course, other people have weddings. People have weddings in registry offices, but registry offices are closed. Pubs are shut. Most schools are shut. The one I'm working in is open because it works with vulnerable children. So there are issues about whether you think lockdowns are a good or a bad idea.
Martin,
you
that's
think
not
they're
what
a bad idea.
Martin, I tend to think Martin, you're just obscuring the issue deliberately. That we're talking about here is one of the most important things in somebody of faith's life is their wedding. And here what we're seeing is a destruction by the police of a Jewish wedding, and there isn't any apparent interest by the government in making exceptions to these rules for these important religious events. Are you saying that you just don't actually think that religion is important at all?
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the rules have got to be the same for everybody, and that implies to weddings, whether they're Jewish or otherwise. If all weddings are banned for the duration, they're banned,
For example, business meetings are not banned by this legislation. You have to be socially distanced, but you can do them. Whereas apparently, church services are allowed in churches, and yet some are not. So this is actually quite an important event, and one would have expected any kind of sensible moral world where human rights were respected, that at the very least, if you can have a business meeting, then you can have a wedding of some kind if it's done within the rules. What's happening is these events are being driven underground.
Well, I don't think you can have business meetings, can you? I mean, you've got to show that you're an essential business and all the rest of it. I mean, we've had a ridiculous situation where we were all told last year to work from home. Then Rishi Sunak told us to go to work and open the pubs. And then they said, oh, no, start working from home again. So we're facing this way and that way and the other way.
Well,
now, that
next
is really
to me,
a problem because it shows
about
that they don't know what they're doing.
Five building sites here in my immediate vicinity of me, where I am in St. Paul's, each one of them is absolutely heaving with building workers. Certainly, I wouldn't say necessarily 150 on one building site, but say something like half that number. And yet, if you want to have a wedding, you can't. But if you want to build a building for a mega buck speculator, that's fine. Just go ahead.
Well, there are questions about the whole idea of trying to open up the economy and to have some kind of a trade-off between lockdown and allowing the economy to function. I don't think there is a trade-off. I think there's a very good post about this from Simon Wren-Lewis some weeks ago on his blog about how this is similar to the expectations-adjusted Phillips curve. Now, the expectations-adjusted Phillips curve, I'll go into detail because it's a bit technical about economics, but it's about tolerating a certain amount of inflation. And what the expectation-adjusted Phillips curve showed in the 1980s and 1990s was that if you tolerate any inflation, it gradually builds and builds exponentially and can potentially undermine your economy. The same goes with COVID. There isn't actually any economically viable level of COVID that you can put up with. And of course, the countries which took that on board at the beginning, specifically New Zealand and China, have now got their economies back and everybody can have weddings.
So would you like to tell us, Martin, when Jews are going to be allowed to get married in Britain? And remember, this is potentially an anti-Semitic answer you're going to give.
No, it's not. The rules will be the same for everybody. If weddings are allowed, Jews will be allowed to have weddings. If weddings aren't to be allowed, funerals are still going to be allowed, but only certain numbers of people can turn up. That's what you have during lockdowns.
And when can we have the first proper Jewish wedding in Britain then, from now on, according
to
you?
I don't know, Tony. It depends how quickly we get rid of COVID, like in New Zealand and China. And since we're run by a lot of public school twerps who don't believe in lockdowns, we're
going to
be stuck in lockdown a very long time.
Are you saying never?
I'm not saying never. I'm just pointing out, Tony, that in New Zealand or in China, weddings and all businesses are now functioning because they did everything right in dealing with the crisis.
Yeah, but can you see what I'm saying here?
The government here has done everything wrong.
Can you see what I'm saying here? Is people of religious beliefs in this particular fashion are basically being forced, if they want to carry on with those beliefs, to break the law.
Well, people who want to take illegal drugs, which should be legal in my view,
unfortunately,
are forced to break the law, aren't
unfortunately,
they?
Unfortunately, drug takers are not a protected category like faiths are, Martin.
No, but faiths or anything else, the rules have got to be the same for everybody, haven't they? They've got to be the same. Now, if we're going to allow weddings, let's allow weddings and everybody can have weddings. But of course, basis, Tony, you're going to have more infections than you would otherwise have.
If the rules are the same for everybody, how come we can have building sites operating normally but no Jewish weddings?
Because building sites are supposedly the economy. And that's what, and of course, we're now saying that the building sites at one stage in Bristol, while you were in New Zealand, they weren't functioning. Yeah? They had the first lockdown, building sites weren't allowed to function. Now, what's actually happened is that instead of sticking to the lockdown as they did in New Zealand, we didn't, and we had eat out to help out, and building sites were opened, and things went back to normal, inverted commas, except it wasn't normal. And in actual fact, you predicted on this show so before Christmas that there would be no second wave. I can't hear any word of apology for you from you on any of these shows that we've had, because there's definitely a second wave. More people died today of COVID in this country than died at the height of the first wave last year. And as you may have seen that Toby Young, who also said that there would be no second wave in the Daily Telegraph, he has been censured by the Press Complaints Authority, and they've had to put in an apology for him saying those things. You, on the other hand, with your podcast, can say all these things and you won't be censured, and you won't have to put out any kind of apology for getting it wrong. But nevertheless, you are clinging to your Custer's last stand on lockdown is the evil. The evil is COVID, and COVID's probably a biological warfare attack on China that's gone wrong. But the Chinese are ahead of the game, and unfortunately, the cannibals that run the West are on the back foot.
I consider you to be a cannibal, Martin. You just want us to have an authoritarian system like China here.
Definitely a socialist, Tony, and I believe in society. And that so during World War II, people who sold stuff on the black market were breaking the law, and many of them were sent to prison. And people had to wear gas masks, and everybody had to learn how to use them. Because when you're at war, Tony, it's not just a question of your personal rights to do this, that, or the other. And especially when you're dealing with an infectious disease, which is quite likely a biological weapon, the idea that I'm allowed to do what I like and I don't care what the consequences are for other people is essentially an antisocial attitude.
Well, it's also an antisocial attitude for the PCR tests to be entirely relied on as a COVID death, and also to be encouraging people to test positive and then give them a £500 bonus if they do. That's also dodgy. And we've had a lot of reports that the National Health Service in January every year since 2012 has been in the similar sort of situation with a lack of ICU, intensive care unit beds, with the entire National Health Service being overwhelmed every January since 2012. So it's hardly surprising that they're being overwhelmed now, apparently, with another strain of COVID. But let's have a look at some of the other news stories that are COVID-related. I mean, that one I just mentioned, Martin, from the World Health Organization, they're saying that the test results do not correspond with the clinical presentation. Sorry, where test results do not correspond with the clinical presentation, a new specific specimen must be taken and retested using different NAT technology. So what the World Health Organization is saying this week is on the 20th of January press release is that there is a serious problem with the PCR tests, and that you, if you get a positive PCR test, all this is an indication that you may have active COVID-19, and that you should then be sent to confirm that by other means. So it does imply, doesn't it, that we're getting quite a lot of false positives from the PCR, as we've been hearing over many months now.
Well, I mean, these are technical questions about whether this test is effective or not. But you'll understand that if you're trying to deal with an infection like this, you need to find out who and who hasn't got it. And of course, that's exactly what the Chinese are doing in Hubei province at the moment. They've built a whole new isolation complex for 4,000 people so that they can try and contain the outbreak that has taken place there. And they're talking in terms of something like 30 or 40 people dead so far. We've had over 1,000 people die today in Britain. Today.
With COVID-19, not necessarily
not really of COVID, but I think it's grasping at straws, Tony.
No, it isn't grasping at straws, because we know that there's a between 5 and 10% false positives rate with the PCR test. So many of those will be false positives. And certainly it's not fair to say that these people have died of COVID-19, only that they may have died with COVID-19. So let's at least agree to disagree on that one. You've put your point of view and I've put mine. So there is also, I think, one of the most important things out this week is this excellent documentary. I mean, I'm reminded of things like Loose Change and Ludicrous Diversion, which came out in 2005 after the 7/7 London bombings, which is doing a really, I think, important analysis that we're not seeing on any of the mass media. In fact, we're seeing the opposite. We're seeing hysteria on the mass media. But what they're doing in the new normal, which is this new documentary, is taking a much, much bigger view, and particularly looking at Bill Gates and his friends' massive power and massive wealth that's been being pumped into this whole idea of mandating vaccines in European countries, and actually using vaccines to test on guinea pigs in the developing world. So let's have a listen to the first clip from that now. And this is where the documentary looks at the bigger picture, that is to say, things like road pricing. Now, road pricing is something I can remember having an off-the-record briefing at the Department of Transport back in, gosh, it must have been 1988, all that time ago, where they were talking to me about they wanted to bring in road pricing, but they weren't sure how they were going to get away with it because the roads lobby was so strong. Now, you know, the idea of now is becoming normalized, isn't it? The congestion charge, they called it, in London. And so let's have a listen to this now, which is where they take us through quite a lot of the various ideas to do with what is actually behind all this. And the documentary, of course, is called The New Normal. They look also at the World Economic Forum and their role.
Many of Boris Johnson's new policies fall in line with the World Economic Forum's objectives. In November 2020, his new Green Industrial Revolution plan included a ban on petrol and diesel cars by 2030. Combined with other current restrictions, such as blocking vehicle access to side roads, causing gridlock on main roads, extending the congestion zone, and introducing a pay-per-mile road tax. One might think that he's attempting to remove ownership of cars.
The biggest application is the autonomous driving. This is going to replace the entire transportation that we're used to today. You will no longer buy cars. Your car is parked 96% of the time, so it's depreciating. How bad is that for an investment, right? Only 4% of the time is it getting you from place A to place B. But imagine there is an Uber that gets here in 30 seconds and is very reliable, very clean, and there's no nasty driver because there is no driver, and it's very safe. Would you not buy a car? One thing about AI is it gets better with data. In 10 years after its first launch, it'll probably be so much better than people, most of us will be afraid to drive. You know why? Because autonomous vehicles will start talking to each other. they will miss each other by 1 centimeter. And we as humans will become our worst enemies, because we're going to be the threat to our lives. The machines are going to be safe. And pretty soon after that, humans will be disallowed from driving.
Suppose you're a 50 years old truck driver and you just lost your job to a self-driving vehicle. Now, there are new jobs in designing software or in teaching yoga to engineers. But how does a 50 years old truck driver reinvent himself or herself as a software engineer or as a yoga teacher? Because AI is nowhere near its full potential. All jobs will disappear, new jobs will emerge, but then the new jobs will rapidly change and vanish.
At the World Economic Forum 2020 annual meeting in Davos, historian, philosopher, and author Yuval Noah Harari warned the audience about the dangers of artificial intelligence.
We hear so much about the enormous promises of technology, and these promises are certainly real, but technology might also disrupt human society and the very meaning of human life in numerous ways, ranging from the creation of a global useless class to the rise of data colonialism and of digital dictatorships. Those who fail in the struggle against irrelevance would constitute a new useless class. And this useless class will be separated by an ever-growing gap from the ever more powerful elite. We are already in the midst of an AI arms race, with China and the USA leading the race and most countries being left far, far behind. AI will likely create immense wealth in a few high-tech hubs, while other countries will either go bankrupt or will become exploited data colonies. Just think, what will happen to developing economies once it is cheaper to produce cars in California than in Mexico? And what will happen to politics in your country in 20 years when somebody in San Francisco or in Beijing knows the entire medical and personal history of every politician and every journalist in your country, including all their sexual escapades, all their mental weaknesses, and all their corrupt dealings? When you have enough data, you don't need to send soldiers in order to control a country.
Between the beginning of the pandemic and August 2020 alone, seven Silicon Valley tech giants added nearly $2.5 trillion to their market values, $400 billion of which was added by Microsoft. Founder Bill Gates also has an interest in vaccines, where he, through the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, owns stock in the vaccine manufacturing companies Pfizer and Moderna. Both companies have been developing a new generation of vaccines that interacts directly with our DNA. Traditional immunization methods involve injecting a dead or a weakened form of the virus. This triggers the immune system to create antibodies, which helps to protect us in the case of a virus getting into our system. Pfizer's and Moderna's new messenger RNA technology, however, is not a standard immunization vaccine, but rather genetic engineering. Instead of injecting a virus into the patient, their approach is to inject synthetic molecules that transport instructions to the cell on how to create antibodies to fight the virus. Up until November 2020, no messenger RNA vaccine had ever been approved for use on humans. On the 21st of November 2020, The Lancet expressed disappointment that the COVID-19 vaccine trial results were announced via press releases, leaving many scientific uncertainties due to the lack of safety data.
Right, so that's a little clip there from the documentary The New Normal, and we're going to hear another one in a minute. Martin, there's a lot of stuff in there about artificial intelligence, a much, much bigger agenda than just a lockdown, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, during the last lockdown, I actually read three of the guys' books, the Israeli guy I've gotten his name. I read his three books, and of course he was speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos. So in a way, there he is warning the elite of the dangers of elite control. So you know, there's a slight sort of what's going on here going on. Yeah, I mean, people go to the World Economic Forum. You remember when Bono went years ago, and NGOs are sometimes invited, and Lula da Silva was invited at one stage to go to the World Economic Forum because they're trying to build up this idea that they care about the environment, they care about inequality. But of course, as we know, they're basically the elite. And, you know, they like to pretend that they're listening to other voices. But the reality is that this is their agenda. And that's what's going ahead. I mean, we mentioned Karl Marx earlier in the first part of the show. And of course, he predicted that what will ultimately happen, that the falling rate of profit of capitalism, nothing to do with fraud, is to do with technology, because ultimately labor is displaced by capital. But of course, capital is dead labor. It can't actually produce anything. Labor is the sole source of value. The labor theory of value was used to be fundamental to economic thinking before the late 19th century. And the problem for capitalism is, as the technology basically exponentially increases the productivity per hour of the worker, it displaces the workers, who are ultimately the source of demand for the goods produced. And this causes crisis, which can only be prevented by the creation of debt. And that's where debt fundamentally comes from. And this is all in traditional Marxist theory. And as Trotsky said a long time ago, long before the world turns into a situation where one monkey presses a button to produce everything, the working class, in other words, the vast majority of the population, will rise up and overthrow capitalism and bring in a different kind of society, a society in which people will be provided with goods, but without having to do any work, because that's what the marvelous machines we've invented are supposed to be doing for us. And of course, the fear is that the AI will be used by the powerful elite to enslave the majority of the population, rather than, as Marx would have said, should be the case, that this fantastic productivity of the human mind should be create a society of abundance in which work will be minimized and we will actually fulfill our humanity. That's the theory. But of course, the reality, and he, of course, was born in the 19th century, where people had this idea of progress, that things were likely to get better. Of course, we, after the terrible 20th century, we're quite convinced, you know, we're much more aware of the possibility that, although the possibility of progress is there, more likely is we're going to mess it up and we won't get through this.
So what do you make of this, at least what this documentary is talking about, as this is a massive power grab?
Obviously, I haven't seen the whole documentary, so it's very hard to say what's in it. You obviously have.
Martin, I'm only asking you really to comment on what you've just heard.
Yeah, well, I'll comment on what I've just heard. I mean, from my point of view, all of this stuff that's directed towards the World Economic Forum in Davos, Gates and all the rest of it, yes, it's certainly the case that even if it's just disaster capitalism, the same forces which brought us the 2008 crash and the 2001 9/11 and all the rest of it, they are basically profiteering on the back of the crisis that we're in. And of course, it may well be worse than that they've actually engineered the crisis. I mean, they certainly carried out 9/11. The 2008 crash was predictable. They basically, you know, they've made more money as a result of that crash than they were making before it. All of this is true, but it's not true of the whole world. Bill Gates's vaccines are not going to be used in China anytime soon. The Sputnik vaccine has just been agreed to be used in Hungary. It's going to be used in Argentina. And this, of course, is not this high-tech Pfizer vaccine, which is not even a vaccine, a new kind of technology altogether. And yes, there is definitely a power play by the old elites in the West that have dominated the international system since Columbus discovered America in 1492. But they have not necessarily got all the firepower. The Chinese economy, as we speak, is going to grow this year and next year by up to 8%. Meanwhile, the capitalist economy, the full-on capitalist economy in the West, is it simply cannot shake off the problem that they've got with being infested with virus and having an insolvent banking system. Ultimately, as Chairman Mao said, the East Wind will prevail over the West Wind, and the Western powers are not necessarily going to be the winners.
Well, that's interesting, that because that kind of is in parallel with what the Freemasons say. They always talk about, you know, this is in from the East, a man traveling from the East to the West. So a lot of it, I think, is about Eastern spiritual systems taking over from Western spiritual systems. But let's have a little listen now to another clip from The New Normal. And obviously, I'll put a link up on our show page to that. This is the sort of documentary which would be yanked within about 10 milliseconds from YouTube these days, because quite a lot of what it says is simply not allowed on YouTube. Even though it's absolutely credible, it's classed as what YouTube calls medical misinformation. So the only correct medical information is that coming from the official sources, and even at the World Health Organization is contradicting those. So one would expect that the World Health Organization channels would be being yanked by YouTube right now. But obviously there's a much bigger agenda, and YouTube is now being used and exploited by Google and by the tech giants in order to simply censor information, Soviet style. But the new normal, the second clip we're going to hear from that, is looking at this as potentially something, pandemic was planned beforehand. And they look here at what maybe the end game might be.
If this pandemic was planned, why would now be the perfect time to activate it? The answer could be 5G. It's 100 times faster than 4G, and it's now ready to be rolled out. This upgrade in performance is essential for digitizing society, connecting humanity more closely with the Internet of Things and artificial intelligence.
They haven't done a very good job about protecting public health, but they've done a very good job at using the quarantine to bring 5G into all of our communities and to begin the process of shifting us all to a digital currency, which is the beginning of slavery. Because if they control your bank account, they control your behavior. And we all see these advertisements saying 5G is coming to your community. It's going to make all of your lives so much better. And it's very convincing, I have to say.
This is a game changer.
Because I look at those ads and I think, that's great. I can hardly wait till it gets here. Because I'm going to be able to download a video game in 6 seconds instead of 16 seconds. And is that why they're spending $5 trillion on 5G? No. The reason is for surveillance and data harvesting. It's not for you and me. It's for Bill Gates. It's for Zuckerberg. And it's for Bezos and all of the other billionaires. Bill Gates says that his satellite fleet will be able to look at every square inch of the planet 24 hours a day. But that's only the beginning. He also will be able to follow you on all of your smart devices through biometric facial recognition, through your GPS. You think that Alexa is working for you. She isn't working for you. She's working for Bill Gates, spying on you. And the pandemic is a crisis of convenience for the elites who are dictating these policies. It gives them the ability to obliterate the middle class, to destroy the institutions of democracy, to shift all of our wealth from all of us to a handful of billionaires, to make themselves rich by impoverishing the rest of us.
If you know enough biology and you have enough computing power and data, you can hack my body and my brain and my life. A system that understands us better than we understand ourselves, can predict our feelings and decisions, can manipulate our feelings and decisions, and can ultimately make decisions for us. Now, in the past, many tyrants and governments wanted to do it, but nobody understood biology well enough, and nobody had enough computing power and data to hack millions of people. Neither the Gestapo nor the KGB could do it. But soon, at least some corporations and governments will be able to systematically hack all the people. We humans should get used to the idea that we are no longer mysterious souls. We are now hackable animals. The power to hack human beings can, of course, be used for good purposes, like providing much better healthcare. But if this power falls into the hands of a 21st century Stalin, the result will be the worst totalitarian regime in human history, and we already have a number of applicants for the job.
Yes, quite a lot of applicants for these sorts of superpower jobs. Not a single one of the mainstream either news wires or newspapers has even reviewed this film. The only ones that have are the Bilderberg-run Reuters. They've done a fact check on it where they say, so if you want to do a search for the new normal, it's the new normal documentary, you will find only Reuters pops up, and where they say multiple misleading suggestions are made in an hour-long documentary. So that's the only thing you place you'll find it even mentioned in the mass media, Martin. Yeah, it's actually quite a devastating take that you're not going to see at all on the television.
Yeah, well, I mean, the final clip there was from the Israeli guy, Yuval, I've forgotten his full name, but he basically, he's a best-selling author. Yeah, I mean, I read all three of his books last year during the lockdown because everybody else was reading them. So, in other words, the film is taking material which is mainstream, and then it's extrapolating from that, I presume.
Well, that's what we do every week.
Yes, indeed. So, in other words, and of course, there is clearly an agenda of control going on in terms of media. And, you know, I think that, you know, you can make a legitimate case for, you know, trying to control to some extent the sort of medical messages that mainstream media are putting out during a pandemic. But this is far beyond that. This is an attempt to control, you know, political opinions about things like, you know, the Chinese control of the South China Sea or whatever it is, you know, basically political questions, nothing to do with anything medical. And yes, I would say that why it's happening now is not because of 5G, it's because of the financial services system, which we were analysing in the first part of the show, collapsed in September last year. They always knew it was going to collapse. And then if there had been no COVID pandemic, they'd have had to turn around and say, sorry, folks, remember how the financial system collapsed in 2008 and we had to bail it all out. And we said we got it all sorted. Well, sorry, we've got to put our hands up again and say we've done it again.
Well, if we're talking about why, if it's a pandemic, why now? I would suggest it's something else as well. I mean, you know, it's an alternative one, and it's great to have, you know, I think in analysis like this, which is taking bits and pieces of very well substantiated, but just kind of arranging it in a different way, which is a different analysis, a different interpretation, an interpretation which is a thought crime now in modern Britain. And mine is that I believe, at least there's, you know, I think quite a lot of evidence that the elites of the world were extremely annoyed. In fact, I met some of them face to face who were very annoyed with the idea of a Brexit vote in 2016, and that this plan for controlling Europe through Brussels by big corporate fascist elites has been completely scuppered by Brexit, and it's made a mess of all of their plans. And I do believe that there are people out there who would go so far as to, you know, attempt to destroy democratic systems right across the world as they see the Brits put two fingers up to the post-war Brussels corporate control project. So that's my take. You've had your take, Martin. But look, let's have a look particularly at a undermining of politics here in Britain. I mean, I talked about the satanic play of Carrie Simmons and her love of Aleister Crowley, who's sitting in Downing Street right now. But what about the Labour Party? Because we've had a... I mean, I know you voted for Keir Starmer, Martin, didn't you, as Labour leader? I wonder if you're having second thoughts, because he's hired this week a former Israeli spy. Asa Winstanley in the Electronic Indifanda has pointed out the UK Labour Party's hired a former Israeli spy to help manage its social media. Asaf Kaplan will work in the London office of Labour leader Keir Starmer, a source with knowledge of the higher said. Kaplan was in Israeli military intelligence for 5 years, an officer in Unit 8200, its cyber warfare branch. Unit 8200 specialises in spying, hacking and encryption. It carries out blackmail, mass surveillance and systematic discrimination against Palestinians. Is this the right guy to do the social media communications for the Labour Party?
Okay, well, let's deal with him. But first of all, I think it's a bit narcissistic to imagine that the global elite are that bothered about Brexit one way or the other.
Martin, you had your say. Martin, rather than waste everybody's time having a Barney about your opinion and my opinion, we have to agree to disagree and then move on and discuss something which the listeners will be interested in.
Okay, but I mean, you ended that, and therefore you think you've ended the discussion. Not necessarily so. Okay, let's come back to Scott.
I've had my say, and we both have different opinions, and we're not going to agree. So there's really no...
You extraneously brought Brexit into it.
No, I didn't. I don't think it's extraneous.
Satanism into a discussion of the financial services sector.
Martin, it's my opinion and your opinion, and we both had our say. Now, can you please address this issue of the Israeli intelligence?
No, it's quite clear what's going on. All right, let's talk about him. It's quite clear he's the wrong person for the job. He's been, this is part of the Israeli government infiltration of mainstream British politics. And, there's plenty of good stuff analysing all of this on the Jewish Voice for Labour blog. And they send stuff out every day of very detailed analysis of what's wrong with all of this. And you asked me whether I regret voting for Keir Starmer. No, because I knew exactly what was going to happen. We need to change the electoral system so it's not just a question of Keir Starmer or Boris Johnson or Rishi Sunak removing Boris Johnson. We should have a democratic system like in Italy or Ireland or Denmark or Norway. And that where we have a situation where 57% of the people voted for parties at the last election who wanted a second referendum on Brexit. The 43% who voted Tory have got the hard Brexit they wanted. So to claim that the Brexit is two fingers up to the global establishment, it's going ahead, Tony. You're going to get Brexit.
And it's Martin, we're not talking about Brexit. We're talking about the Israeli infiltration of the Labour Party here. Yes. We had a documentary on Al Jazeera. We had a documentary on Al Jazeera called The Lobby, where Shai Massot, the political attaché at the Israeli embassy, was offering... he had a slush fund of around about £1 million in order to get rid of Corbyn and people like that in the Labour Party and put people like Mr. Starmer in. It seems like, you, by voting for Starmer, have actually helped that, because we've now got Israeli intelligence running social media comms for Labour.
He's actually a personal friend of Shai Massot, this guy. So it's worse than you say. But the choice we had in the election for the Labour Party leadership was Rebecca Long-Bailey, who was a continuation of the Corbyn policy. And if she'd come out in favour of changing the electoral system, I would have voted for her. Keir Starmer hasn't ruled it out. See, Rebecca Long-Bailey was stuck in the same old trench that Jeremy Corbyn was stuck in, is that he didn't want to change the electoral system, because the idea is that on 42% of the vote, you could have got a Labour majority in Parliament and then they could have done anything they wanted. It's a fantasy. And of course, I voted for Keir Starmer because he kept the question open of whether there's going to be a potential change of the electoral system. But I did it with my eyes open. I'm not at all surprised that he's brought somebody like this in. And of course, what we're going to do is we're going to have a massive fight about this. People in the Labour Party up and down the country are saying we're not happy with the direction of travel here. Now, of course, Starmer is actually doing quite well in the opinion polls for sticking with the majority of public opinion in favour of tougher lockdowns. And of course, that is actually what people want. Whether they should want it is another matter. But well, of course, not, I mean, ultimately, we're going to have to change the political system,
Martin. I don't think
it will be changed through chaos rather than through.
You can't state as fact that people want more lockdowns. There's certainly some.
Look at the opinion polls, Tony. You will see that the government have been behind the curve on this all the way.
There's certainly some opinion polls that say that, but anecdotally, if you go out there, particularly on our roads and our motorways and our building sites, you'll see they're not interested in lockdowns. They want to earn a crust, and they want it all over with by whatever means. Before we hear from this week's excellent documentary, it's nice to be able to say something positive about mainstream TV. I thought I'd just revisit briefly 1926 back on the BBC, where we had a radio revolution hoax. And in fact, there's even a BBC page about it, a guy called Ronald Knox. Now, for many years, I thought that Orson Welles' War of the Worlds was the first time this had ever happened on CBS in the late 1930s in the United States, where millions of Americans were scared to death that there'd been a Martian invasion, when actually it was a play by Orson Welles, a fantastic play, albeit. But in January 1926, one of his regular BBC radio programmes, Ronald Knox broadcast a pretended live report of a revolution sweeping across London entitled Broadcasting from the Barricades. In addition to live reports of people, including a government minister, being lynched, his broadcast cleverly mixed supposed band music from the Savoy Hotel with the hotel's destruction by trench mortars. The Houses of Parliament and the Clock Tower were flattened in the documentary. But Martin, this is in a way it's a kind of psychological warfare exercise done in 1926 Britain, which was predated by something like 15 years the Wells experiment in the United States.
It would be very interesting to find out, and I don't know if you can say this, Tony, or you know the question I'm going to ask, was this before or after the general strike? Because if it was before the general strike, it would have been possibly part of psychological warfare by MI5 or similar connected structures.
Actually, it was about three months before the general strike.
Well, and therefore, isn't that interesting, because that is probably the closest Britain came to revolution during that era. And and of course, it's the era of the Zinoviev letter, which supposedly showed how the Soviets were funding the Labour Party, although in fact it was a load of nonsense made up by MI5. And you can imagine.
Made up, by the way, by Major Desmond Morton, private secretary to Winston Churchill. Yeah. He was the guy behind the Zinoviev letter.
Yeah, well, it may be that this, you know, radio show was an attempt to frighten the public about, you know, the takeover of power by the Soviets with the Labour, you know, I don't know, because I didn't, you know, it's
you're right about the timing is fascinating, isn't it? So that's just almost exactly 3 months, this programme, before the general strike broke out. So what are you suggesting that they were trying to do with this as a propaganda broadcast then?
Well, they probably realised that there was going to be a general strike, because it was about keeping the pound on the gold standard, which meant basically cutting miners' wages. And the miners, of course, were quite militant. And, the general population after the First World War had got, you know, a more militant attitude towards things like this. And the general strike actually ultimately petered out and was a bit of a damp squib.
Well, it lasted for 9 days at the beginning of May 1926. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously, when it came down to it, the TUC just climbed down. The miners stayed out on strike for many months afterwards, but the general strike was called off. Now, of course, the establishment in Britain would probably have seen the general strike coming. Don't forget, they're cutting the miners' wages. They know that they're going to have a showdown. It was a planned showdown, and therefore this little radio show thing could have been part of the softening up process that they were engaging in before the showdown with the miners and the rest of the workers who supported the miners.
Okay, so shame. I'm not sure if there's actually a recording of that. Maybe they didn't. Maybe they binned it or wiped it, as the BBC seemed to be so good at doing. But apparently the script of the broadcast has been reprinted in a book, Essays in Satire, which was published in 1928, and it was entitled in that book A Forgotten Interlude. But anyway, thankfully, not all of what the BBC and ITV and the rest of them do is propaganda. And this week, there was a fantastic, excellent documentary about care homes on the ITV Tonight strand. And we're going to hear a clip from that now, which is about Leandra Ashton, the former Coronation Street. And one does wonder if the only reason that they ever covered this is because she has connections to Granada Television and knows people personally within the media. It's almost like a clique you have to be in order to get anything covered these days. Leandra Ashton and her 97-year-old nan, who they tried to take out of the care home because they believed that she wasn't being properly cared for in there. And they are obviously her daughter and her granddaughter are very close to her, and they should really be able to make that decision as to whether they think that she's being correctly cared for or not. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to Leandra Ashton and her mother, Liana, and her nan, who's Tina, and what happened to them as they tried to take her out of the care home. And as this documentary explains, what is their position on all this now that her nan is finally back at home?
Each home makes its own visiting policy. Many haven't been able to hug since last March.
Which police station are you taking her to?
Should we go into home?
Leandra Ashton, a former Coronation Street actress, tried to break the separation by breaking her grandmother, Tina, out of her home.
So let's just make this very clear. My 97-year-old nan here, who we have taken from the care home, is now being taken back by force to her care home. My mother has been arrested. My mother is in the back of the car here. She is a nurse.
Her mother, Yelena, was arrested for allegedly assaulting a carer with a bunch of roses and told she had no right to take her relative.
Nan, I love you and we are going to fight for you.
The last 9 months and our inability to visit her face to face has led to this dreadful situation where she's deteriorating. It's not only affecting her, but it's affecting us as a family as well.
I would do it again. I'd be arrested. I don't care what it takes. But yes, no, I have absolutely no regrets.
Yelena wasn't charged, but at the next window visit, things took another turn.
Right. Well, can I tell you, for the record, that her colour is very poor?
The family called 999.
Hang on a minute. Before you go.
The care home say paramedics and later a GP had no concerns about Tina and the home had not fallen short.
Hang on a minute. Don't take her away. Hey, don't take her away.
Carers close the blinds on what the home say was challenging behaviour. We'll revisit the family later as they fight not to be shut out of Tina's life. It's been over a month since the bid to break Tina free. After a long battle, her family can finally take her home.
It's incredibly emotional. It's a huge relief, and we just want to get her home now and get her to just. We just want to get her home.
Tina has been home for a week, and the family have invited me for a COVID-safe visit.
I mean, the day that Mum came home, yeah, we kind of didn't really stop crying, and we all held hands, and we sang and we celebrated, just this massive celebration of love.
Do you think to some extent she's coming back to herself then?
She's eating better, yeah. She's sleeping better, she's calmer.
It's a sign of love.
And
she'll never go back into a care home.
No way. And I'll tell you this, man, I don't think anyone has the right, government, public health, care home to tell anyone that they cannot be with their loved ones. It's up to us to decide the level of risk that we are willing to take.
COVID has shone a light on all that is wrong with the system.
So that's a little extract from the ITV Tonight documentary, which was on last night, about care homes with Leandra Ashton, her mum, Vienna, and her 97-year-old nan, Tina, finally managing to get her back home and look after her at home, as they're able to do. Martin, it's almost like, you know, elderly relatives are like property, and they're property of the care homes, not of the family.
Yeah, well, I seem to remember something about this case some while ago. And, you know, individual cases are individual cases. The question of whether care homes should be locked down or not locked down is a wider question. And, of course, I don't believe
that's
not, it.
Martin, that's not really what this is about. It's about who decides on care for elderly loved ones, whether it's care homes or the family. Because in this particular case, you know, it's quite obvious, and we heard this from the relatives and relatives and residents association last week, that insurance companies are basically dictating policy in these care homes. They're saying, well, you're insured to do this, you're not insured to do that, therefore never allow this, and you can only do that.
Yeah, because of the privatisation of the care home system under Margaret Thatcher. I mean, there used to be council-run care homes, which are run according to certain regulations.
Yeah, it's the same insurance companies will be insuring the public care homes and the private care homes, surely. It's about insurance.
This,
it's not
this
about
particular,
who owns
the
care
In this particular home. Case, it may be to do with, you know, what the insurance company have said to the care home. But I would like to focus on the wider question of whether care homes can or should be locked down in lockdowns. Now, I don't agree with this, but if you're going to have a herd immunity strategy, then you have got to allow those who are supposed to be shielding to be shielded. And that means, for example, that care homes have to be off limits for people who are going to work in building sites and going to Jewish
weddings. What about
so
limits to carers who are younger?
Well, if this woman... I can't see how it couldn't have been discussed. Is this woman better off in the care home? Or some? If people want to take her out, they can come and take her out. There shouldn't be any problem with agreeing about that. But the question, which I think is fundamental, is that I don't believe in pursuing herd immunity. But if you do...
No, I don't think anyone's talking about herd immunity here, Martin. This is about whether you've actually witnessed your relative not being properly cared for. That's what the reason they took her out of there is they didn't believe she was being properly cared for, and they actually wanted all of the three of them to take the risk of having some personal contact because none of them had any symptoms of COVID. Surely that's an infringement of their liberties to say that we are going to assume that one of you's got COVID, so you're not allowed to touch each other for a year.
All right, yeah, but I mean, if she's been allowed to go home, hasn't she? They are now looking after her. And the obvious way to do that is just test everybody, check that they're okay, and let her go.
Well, the bizarre thing here is you've got bubbles being formed between care workers and elderly relatives where actually the immediate relatives are not allowed to do that. And people sometimes even working in multiple care homes and then going in and out of those care homes whereas the relatives aren't. Anyway, we discussed quite a lot of this last week, and you can look up the full interview with the Relatives and Residents Association, Helen Wildboar, who's their director, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But we're going to hear another clip from that documentary, which is altogether more tragic. It doesn't have such a positive outcome as Leandra Ashton and her efforts to get her nan out of the care home, which ultimately were successful, even though painful. And that is that a guy called Vernon, who was a care home manager, successful care home manager, who ultimately ended up committing suicide because of what had happened in his home. So let's have a listen to that extract from this documentary last night on the ITV Tonight strand now.
There is real reason to feel alone at Gwastad Hall in Wrexham. The home has always been highly rated, but the lows of the pandemic were too much for the owner's husband.
I should have seen what it was doing to him. But I never. I didn't realise he would ever do that.
Vernon had never had any problems with his mental health, but after seeing so many of his residents lose their lives to the virus, without warning, Vernon took his own.
It was very traumatic watching our patients die. Of course, now we're coming to the stage of vaccines and everybody's going to forget this. March, April, May, well, I can't describe what it was like. We were dealing with, you know, homemade isolation gowns made out of duvets, homemade visors. None of the patients that died during that time, April and May, were tested.
To protect themselves and others, GPs refused to enter the home.
What they decided to do was remotely visit patients. But the Wi-Fi system here is rubbish. So if we went down to a patient's room with a tablet, you lost the Wi-Fi signal. None of these patients were seen by a doctor. Before, during or after death, they were verified by the nurses who worked here.
Only doctors can order oxygen. By the time it was prescribed and delivered, some patients had already passed away.
To watch these patients, they were gasping for oxygen. And I couldn't give them any relief. As a nurse, I found that incredibly hard. And for Vernon to watch that, it was horrendous because we couldn't give them any relief.
The coroner told Helen the pressure of working through the pandemic had overwhelmed him.
I feel that his death's in vain if I don't speak out. The only reason this happened to Vernon was because of the effects of COVID.
Well, that was something which we were unable to challenge because we were taken off the air by Pat Hart, the manager of Bristol Community Radio. It's something that we were challenging off air, this whole idea of discharging people from hospitals without testing into care homes at the time, which may have helped cause that particular tragedy. There's another aspect to this, of course, which is that were the SARS already well-tested remedies, ivermectin and chloroquine, available at that time, many of those people may well not have died. It's just that the government under Matt Hancock and the rest of these incompetent murderers made sure that ivermectin and chloroquine were not available. And even people at the British Medical Association have blood on their hands over this, with an active campaign and the insurance companies to stop ivermectin and stop chloroquine being used with patients as soon as COVID was diagnosed or detected. But Martin, another reason why Vernon committed suicide apparently was because so many people in that care home died, and they were being very open and honest about what was happening to the public, that there was no custom at all for what had been one of the most successful care homes in Wales. Suddenly nobody wanted to go there. They were bankrupt and nobody wanted to go because they saw it as some sort of, even though they've been honest, a kind of COVID cemetery almost.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, it's when people commit suicide, you can impute various things to it. Obviously, his wife thinks it's to do with the things that you're describing. And you mentioned not using, already existing drugs. But I think there is going to be a public inquiry into all of this about how this was managed in this country. And I think the fact that Dominic Cummings was on the SAGE committee that made the decision not to lock down, as Priti Patel is now saying, she was pushing for a lockdown inside the cabinet and was overruled. And these questions are going to come up. And of course, many people are going to conclude after this inquiry is concluded that the problem is not lockdown itself. The problem is that they didn't carry it out sufficiently and in a timely way. And that was to do because of Dominic Cummings' obsession with having a global. He shouldn't have been on the SAGE committee, of course. That only came out because of a leak, because he's a special advisor.
So you think that Neil Ferguson should, do you?
Well, Neil Ferguson is at least qualified to comment. But Cummings definitely isn't. And he shouldn't have been on the committee. And of course, Boris Johnson himself, when he was still being advised by Cummings, made a speech about Brexit, Tony, where he stressed that the keeping of Britain open as a global centre was quite important. All of this then leads to a situation where your care homes are stuck. They did exactly the same thing in Sweden.
Care home deaths have got nothing whatsoever to do with Brexit. They're to do
and COVID's got nothing
disgusting
to do with Brexit. Martin, the decision,
Martin, they've got to do with the disgusting withdrawal of approval for using the basic drugs for SARS on SARS-CoV-2. The drugs which were tested on SARS-CoV-1, on SARS-CoV-2 is an obvious thing to do. But yet many medical professionals made sure that didn't happen because they, I think, wanted as many deaths as possible in this whole procedure in order to scare people into the vaccine agenda. That seems to be where we're heading with all of this. And many, 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 probably tens of thousands just here in the UK of lives could have been saved by those drugs, as we heard very, very clearly last week. Ivermectin saving in some studies up to 92% of people's lives in the early stages, using a control group to test these figures, and roughly something like 3/4 of people could have survived. So that's one thing I would say about investigative journalism and allowing journalists to do their jobs, is it sometimes saves lives rather than just saves reputation and complaints to Ofcom by the Israeli government, which is what happened to our programme a few years ago. One of the things I really like to contest with you, I know you're quite a fan of the masks. I'm not, although, of course, I wear it when it's necessary. We heard a bit from Dr. Stephen Malthouse last week about the consequences of all of this pandemic, which seems to be a move towards mass surveillance. He talked about all sorts of other things, and on his Bridge City News in Alberta, Canada interview, which went on for about 20 minutes of discussion, which you will never hear now on the BBC or any of the other mainstream networks here in the UK, because it's simply censored and banned. So I thought we'd hear a little bit more from Stephen Malthouse as he discusses his views, puts forward his ideas. He's in the same group as our friend from Guernsey Princess Royal Hospital, who was on our show last week. So Dr. Stephen Malthouse now giving his thoughts on masks, how effective they are, whether it really actually makes any difference in the spread or not of COVID-19.
Well, the evidence for masks is actually that they don't work and they're more harmful than we would suspect. And there are various reasons for that. First of all, we're talking about aerosolized tiny particles. These are 0.1 micrograms in size. Microns in size, and so that they are they actually pass out through the sides and tops and bottoms of the mask. They can actually pass right through the mask in many cases because it's aerosolized. It goes out into the air and it can linger in the air for 1 to 3 hours. So there's no way you can contain that by wearing a mask or social distancing. Masks are actually a mistake. The downside of masks are multiple. Physically, they shred, they contain your exhalations, so you're re-inhaling things that are coming out of your own body trying to get rid of them. And so your risk of getting pneumonias and infections, and what dentists are now seeing as mask mouth, are much higher. And there are other things would cause that, they shred, so all sorts of particles come off the masks themselves, which can potentially cause lung disease later in life. But I think one of the major things that we need to look at masks is the psychological effects of masking people. If you're walking around in a community that has masks on, everybody thinks there's something terrifying out there that you should be frightened of, and that is not the case. Secondly, they block facial expression, so people can't relate to each other, taking the humanity out of humans. And for children, it's causing damage to not just their psychology from the point of view of being able to properly socialize, but also their ability to read people's expressions and to learn. So parts of their brains will be affected by that. Additionally, we have also seen that carbon dioxide levels go up and oxygen levels go down with masks. That's pretty clearly shown. OSHA in the United States has demonstrated that multiple times. And we normally would want to fit people for masks and all that stuff and make sure that they are capable of withstanding the low oxygen tensions, the carbon dioxide. No one should be wearing a mask for a long period of time. It's very dangerous to people's health and to their psychology as well. And we're seeing that in communities. If children are frightened and they think also they're going to be killers, they're going to kill their family members if they go close to them. And this is completely untrue. So we're teaching children to be frightened of going near other humans, afraid to go near other family members, and being isolated. And this is actually a torture technique that's used by the CIA.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, Bridge City News, Alberta, Canada there,
with an amazing 20-minute interview with Dr. Stephen Malthouse. Now, I'm sure you don't agree with him on masks, Martin, but, I mean, our point really here we're trying to make is that there needs to be a broad spread of opinions in which hopefully a policy can be put together which has the best of all worlds with different expert opinions all taken into account.
I'm willing to listen to anybody's arguments about anything.
So why aren't the BBC then and the mainstream broadcasters and the newspapers?
Well, no, I mean, let's just, you know, try and unpick some of this, but not with, you know, not going into too much detail. The argument that they make is that when you're dealing with a pandemic or some health threat of this kind, that the messaging about what you should and shouldn't do has to be fairly clear. I mean, they basically employ PR people. I mean,
World Health Organization PR people and to do much of this. But I mean, in a way, your description falls at the first hurdle. Many doctors would say that this does not fall into the category of pandemic. What you've got is a disease which, even when it gets people hospitalized, it has got less than a 1% mortality rate. So it doesn't fit with a pandemic description. That's what some will say.
Well, I'm also in, we've discussed on this show that it may well be a biological warfare agent. And of course, a biological warfare agent isn't designed to kill loads and loads of people. It's designed to wreck your economy unless you handle it properly. And of course, that is exactly what's happened.
It hasn't been handled properly. I think that's one thing we can definitely agree on. It definitely hasn't been handled properly. I mean, my question to you, though, is really more about the press coverage. And I've got an article here from the Lancashire Post out of Manchester, which is actually, no, I think it's maybe Preston, where a Preston councillor has been rushed to hospital with severe COVID vaccine side effects. This is within the last week. This was published 16th of January. A Preston councillor had to be rushed to hospital after suffering extreme side effects from his COVID-19 vaccine. Speaking to the Post, City Councillor Pav Akhtar has described how he was left fearing for his life after being admitted to Royal Preston Hospital within hours of the jab. He spent 24 hours in emergency care immediately after having the Pfizer-BioNTech jab last Friday at Ryan Medical Center in Bamba Bridge. Minutes later, as he was sat in the post-vaccine waiting area, where patients are monitored for adverse reactions, Cohn Akhtar began feeling unwell. Well, this says something in itself, doesn't it? I've had vaccines in the past, and then I was just left to go home. I didn't have to go and sit for half an hour in a post-vaccine waiting area where patients are monitored for adverse reactions. It shows that they are expecting adverse reactions, and maybe you're kind of part of the test by having this. But anyway, within 10 minutes, he said he could tell his breathing pattern had changed. He was having to dig much deeper into his diaphragm to breathe. My breathing went, he says, and I started to feel a bit nervous and clammy. I wasn't sure what was going on. I tried to ignore it and told myself it would pass. Well, I won't read the whole account, but he found himself later in a hospital bed in an isolation unit at Royal Preston Hospital. He'd been taken back to the hospital by an ambulance where he says he didn't have any underlying health conditions that was expected to trigger any reactions. But the flu-like snuffles and muscle aches started, followed by a horrendous fever. When he closed his eyes, he laid down and felt like the top of his scalp was melting and sliding down his face. It was horrible, struggling with breathing and short of breath. So there he is, really almost on the verge of not being able to breathe. The only problem here is that this article came out in the newspaper. It was on the website for one day, and now you can't find it. I was only sent this link from the archive. So there is obvious censorship going on of these adverse reactions to the vaccines. And we saw right at the very start of all this, it would be probably about October time. I think it was the UK column first reported, or various people saw it, but that there was a commission from one of the government institutions to do with all of this. Maybe it was the CDC or something, although it's in the States, whatever they are in the UK. It's the MHRA, wasn't it? The regulators. Saying that they wanted to have an artificial intelligence system. They commissioned one in order to
charter and track all the adverse reactions. So that's one of the reasons why we have heard nothing whatsoever in the British press, really, about adverse reactions to the vaccines, because they're keeping it all hushed up. And they're so worried that ordinary human beings dealing with these adverse reactions might run to the press with some of the horrifying things that they see, that they've had to make artificial intelligence do it. So what I'm saying here, Martin, really, is that there is an obvious understanding amongst the senior people in the government and the regulators and in Big Pharma that these vaccines are going to have bad side effects almost immediately, but they want to make sure that none of this gets to the press.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically, the vaccines have been rushed through. If we're just dealing with a disaster capitalist scenario, and there is no underlying biological warfare attack, and that's possible. I mean, I've been reading some interesting stuff this week about the Wuhan virology lab, and that it may well have come from bat viruses which they had got from southern China, and that they subsequently leaked. But leaving aside all of that, they're definitely rushing these vaccines out, and they're trying to hide the side effects because they want to vaccinate as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, so that they can end the lockdown, so that they can get back to running the economy. So the economy comes first. Now, in actual fact, that's the wrong way round. They cannot fix the economy because they didn't lock down in time. The Chinese have fixed their economy because they did lock down in time. As have the New Zealanders, the people in Taiwan, Vietnam, Cuba, various countries have no COVID. So they can take their time now about doing vaccines. The Chinese are trying to develop a vaccine, but they're not rushing.
So
they're
dropping dead in Belarus and Sweden? I don't think they are, Martin.
Well, no, in Sweden, as you know, Tony, they made all the same mistakes that we made on care homes. People were sent off to care homes who infected the care homes. And of course, they're now having to tighten their lockdown because it didn't. The herd immunity strategy didn't work. It was Rishi Sunak in this country who took a couple of herd immunity people to talk to Boris, which is why we didn't have the lockdown before Christmas. All of this is going to come out in a public inquiry, Tony, ultimately. But of course, the really obvious thing staring everybody in the face is that China, which was supposedly the source of the virus, they don't have any problem with COVID at all now. Everybody doesn't have to wear masks. There's no lockdown because they did it right the first time. And if you don't do it right the first time, you can't go back and try and do it again a different way. I don't think these vaccines are going to work. There's two problems with them. A, they may be dangerous. And B, they may not, in fact, prevent the spread of the virus. And that means that the Chinese will carry on, their economy will carry on growing, and our economy will carry on failing because we failed. And if it is a plot, then it's a failed plot, because the Chinese are going to win World War III and the WEF fascists are going to lose it.
Sweden's new emergency lockdown laws went into effect this month, Martin, but it's nothing like the lockdown laws here. What they have there is the power to lock down specific towns and cities and to seal them off, and they haven't actually used it yet. So what they're doing is a very much more, I would say, sensible approach, which is to identify outbreaks if and when they occur in Sweden to lock things down. But there is no actual lockdown at the moment in Sweden at all. It's just a law they passed so that they can lock down cities if and when they need to, and it hasn't yet been used.
Yeah, but they're still having a surge, as most Western European countries are, having a surge of deaths from COVID. That's not a problem in New Zealand, and it's not a problem in China. And they're not even bothering with vaccines in China. They're developing one, but there's no rush, and they don't have to rush it out because they've done everything right the first time. And of course, if you don't do things right the first time with stuff like this, what we're probably going to have in Western Europe is a continuous problem of half lockdowns, half releases, half lockdowns, and the economy in the doldrums until the banks collapse. Meanwhile, the Chinese are forging ahead.
Okay, so yeah, I think we should, you know, it's quite important. I put a link up to the article on Deutsche Welle about the Swedish lockdown law. So, I mean, that just seems to me as if the Swedes have dealt with this very, very sensibly. And also, it's obviously impossible to stop the spread of a virus once it's already been spreading around for 2 or 3 months, as it was here in the UK. But let's have a listen now to another audio clip. This time, I thought what we'd do is we'd go back, because it's just about a year, isn't it, now, since the first talk about the Wuhan outbreak, and just after that, or not long after that. And, you know, one of the things that I find often in journalism is that things that you look at almost immediately slowly get forgotten about. And we saw this a lot with 9/11, Martin, didn't we, when we were looking at that in the noughties, is there'd be a devastating story about the September the 11th attacks, really showing what a lie the official story was. It would be in one little newspaper or one news outlet, and then it would never be heard or seen again, disappear completely off the face of the earth. And so the analysis was never done by most people, unless they're, you know, journalists themselves, keeping a track of these things. So I thought we'd have a listen back to Syrian Girl. She put out some of the very first criticisms of the initial reaction to the virus. And she pointed out various things. One is this thing called ID 2020, which is a whole program for lockdown measures and preparedness for pandemics that Bill Gates has been funding for many years with his bizarre phoenix looking like a kind of Catholic Christian cross with Jesus on it. But when you look a bit closer to it, you can see it's a phoenix rising from the ashes instead. That's the maybe Bill Gates' little in-joke he likes using there. But anyway, so that was ID 2020. We also had a prediction, didn't we, of a lung-attacking virus back in 1997 from Bill Gates. And that's one of the things that Syrian Girl looks at in this little clip. Now we're going to hear from one of her first reports after the virus outbreak came.
Last month, Bill Gates did an AMA where he suggested a coronavirus vaccine could come with a digital certificate. He passed it off as a faraway hypothetical concept and didn't mention the fact he had been investing in it, nor did he mention that he wants to tattoo that digital certificate into people's skin with quantum dots that will be visible with smartphones. Essentially, he wants to tattoo a Microsoft logo on everyone. So it's not just herd immunity, but herd branding. He stated that we won't be allowed to travel or leave our homes unless we accept this vaccine.
Eventually, what we'll have to have is certificates of who's a recovered person, who's a vaccinated person, because you don't want people moving around the world where you'll have some countries that won't have it under control. Sadly, you don't want to completely block off the ability for those, you know, people to go there and come back and move around. So eventually there will be sort of this digital immunity proof that, you know, will help facilitate the global reopening up.
You may think this plan seems far-fetched, but the British government has already embraced it.
We are looking at an immunity certificate, how we can how people who have had the disease have got the antibodies and therefore have immunity can show that.
The general public may be harder to convince, so they're going to sell them the idea step by step. First, they will suggest that those who have already survived coronavirus and acquired antibodies will be given special privileges, which were previously our rights, such as the ability to travel, go back to work, or even leave our homes. Most people would find this idea quite reasonable, given the dangers of the virus. However, the implications of this are already dystopian. Out of economic desperation, some may choose to purposely infect themselves with the virus in order to gain antibodies. But we don't even know if you can become immune after contracting coronavirus. There have been reports of reinfection, and the virus is constantly mutating. There's even a chance that the virus could be more deadly if you catch it the second time, because your immune system might hyper-respond.
If you contract COVID-19 and survive it, you might be entitled to what is called an immunity passport.
Once people accept this scenario, they'll suggest that only those who have been vaccinated can leave their homes. Anyone who refuses will remain under house arrest. In this way, they won't have to make taking vaccines compulsory, but they can make life unlivable if you refuse. This won't just be for coronavirus. This will eventually apply to other viruses too. Imagine a world where people born with HIV are no longer allowed to travel and are completely isolated from society. Imagine having to declare your entire medical history before entering a building. Imagine those without coronavirus antibodies being forced to wear a star and placed in isolation camps. This won't stop at viruses. Once our God-given freedoms are labeled as privileges that can be taken away, the concept will extend to social credit systems. Perhaps if you become an enemy of the state, you won't be able to even purchase groceries because your digital identifier will block you from doing so.
Yeah, so I mean, it's almost like that was from a year ago. So obviously what she was saying about immunity has now been proven false. You do get immunity, possibly up to 18 years even after initially having COVID-19. Although I suppose I should say you may, because people potentially could get reinfected. But of course, the second version of that infection, even if it is by a slightly different strain, will be far less than the first one. Because your T cells start producing antibodies almost instantly, which stop the virus replicating inside your body. That is to say, if your immune system is working well, if you've had your vitamin C, your vitamin D, your zinc, your omega fish oil, everything should be working swimmingly in there. And a friend of mine I spoke to recently, who's on these various things, says, I take it every day and I've never felt better. And that's because your actually immune system is sitting there geared up, ready and waiting for COVID-19 to turn up. But one of the interesting things she was talking about in there, Martin, was this idea of people deliberately catching COVID in order to build up an immunity so they don't need a vaccine.
Well, I think what she was suggesting was that they would get the vaccine passport so that they could then, you know, go out and do what they wanted to do in society. I can see all of these dystopian visions. I think, and of course, the logical corollary of all of this is that Bill Gates and the WF elite created the virus. They're not just jumping on something that's happened naturally. They have deliberately created it and quite possibly deliberately seeded it in their great enemy, really, communist China. But of course, if that was the goal, it has failed. And what the Chinese will be doing going forward is they're not necessarily going to have a vaccine. They're not necessarily going to vaccinate people until they're so confident that their vaccine is harmless or is going to work. They're going to stick to what they're doing, which is working, which is if you go to China, you'll have to isolate for 14 days and you won't be allowed in unless you do, the same as they're doing in New Zealand. And those economies, and there are several of them in Southeast Asia, will function. The problem is that in the West, their economies won't function. I think what the bad guys wanted was for the Chinese economy to take the worst hit, for it to then flow back over the Western world so that they could then consolidate their power. And, of course, they would then control everything, including inside communist China.
Martin, surely,
but they failed to do that.
I mean, the technocracy is something that doesn't really respect borders of China or America. It's got its tentacles into both sides of that divide.
Well, what you see now in China is they're relying upon their healthcare system, which was developed from the 1940s and is very much a kind of primary healthcare system. It's they that put forward the original concept of the barefoot doctor. We're not going to have a highly specialized medical elite. We're going to train all sorts of ordinary people to do basic healthcare at low cost, so that we do basic stuff well, so that everybody has clean water, which is a major killer in the developing world. Not in China. In India, as we speak, millions of people have no access to modern toiletry. They just have to go and crap wherever. That is not the case in China. all of these things make a huge difference into the, and of course the countries which have done well in dealing with
in rural China, it's surely Martin,
that primary healthcare system.
Sure, I mean, you're talking about urban China. Surely rural China is still pretty poor, parts of it.
No, but in rural China, it's still quite poor, but it's still, in actual fact, that the standards of living in rural China have increased more in recent years than in urban China.
So is it better than Bristol? Because we've got basically a bottom of Stokes Croft where the toilets have been closed around the bear pit. That is, you know, every morning it's basically like an open sewer because
it is an absurdity, is it not, Tony, in a country which has probably got the fifth biggest or sixth biggest economy on the planet, that because of austerity policies pursued by the Tory government over the last 15 years in order to bail out the fraudulent bankers we were discussing at the beginning of the show, we've apparently got no money for public toilets, which were regarded as an absolutely essential piece of infrastructure in the 19th century. And we're closing public toilets in order to play off bankers. And then we wonder why people die in the streets. And it's because our priorities are all wrong. Whereas, of course, in communist China, communist Vietnam, communist Cuba, their priorities are rather different. But, of course, it's not all about liberty. Liberty always implies a responsibility.
We voted for a Labour mayor here in Bristol not to do those things, but that's what he's done anyway, Marvin Rees.
Yeah, because the money has been leached out of local government.
So are you saying he's got no
by
choice?
Austerity? They've lost. Are you saying he's got no choice? Of their budget?
Are you saying that the Bristol's mayor Marvin Rees has got no choice?
Not really. What's the problem with Marvin is he's pretended that there is a solution and that Marvin can deliver it. And in actual fact, there is no solution at local level, not unless you've got the right to borrow and print money, which the central government has got.
He certainly might have helped if he hadn't spent £50 million of our money on Bristol Energy, which is just a complete sabotage of local government operation to drain it of all the resources it needs to do basic stuff. So I don't know why anyone would pay council tax. But anyway, look, we are going to look now, as we begin to wind up, at eugenics. And I just thought there was a guy that spoke at a conference called AV2 a few years ago called Dr. Len Horowitz. He is the author of a book called Emerging Viruses, AIDS and Ebola, looking at the potential for AIDS and Ebola and other types of the viruses being manufactured, man-made. I don't know, maybe before we hear, Martin, what you make of that possibility, because these are conspiracy theories that we thought, certainly when I first heard that, black Africans were being injected with AIDS, I thought, that's ridiculous. That must be a conspiracy theory. It can't be true. But in that documentary, Cold Case Hammarskjöld, there we have an individual who was actually part of that program to deliberately inject black Africans with the AIDS virus under the guise of it being a vaccine. So there you go. And sometimes these conspiracy theories do turn to facts, and they're the only reason someone is calling it a conspiracy theory is because they're a criminal that's trying to cover it up, BBC. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to an excerpt from a speech at AB2 by Dr. Len Horowitz, where he talks about what he calls a kind of big pharma Fourth Reich cartel of eugenics. Let's have a listen to him now.
When Osama bin Laden was tracked to Afghanistan in a cave, and you remember, for those of you who are awake, the Osama bin Laden family, then that it was through the dealings through Carlyle Group that they had tons of investments together. One of those investments was in Bioport LLC, the only main vaccine maker for anthrax. Now, Acanbus is working on smallpox, and if you are an avid investigator and somebody who sincerely appreciates meticulous scientific referencing, then what you should get is the book DNA, Pirates of the Sacred Spiral, because that book tells you who stole the Human Genome Project. Ultimately, you get to George Soros and boys. Controlling Acanbus, controlling the J. Craig Venter, from the Human Genome Project. All of these folks who were engaged in privatizing the university and public Research Laboratory's efforts to unravel the human genome. 2 weeks before it was supposedly completed, it was privatized, and Acambus is heart and soul central to the smallpox vaccine production, which was totally getting the genetically engineered viral strains from this clique of researchers and profiteers. So look what your independent says about this company. Acambus, a biotech company best known for its smallpox vaccine, is negotiating a transforming acquisition of the vaccine business in the U.S. pharmaceutical group Baxter International. Now you're going to see a little bit of the shell game. You know, the where you put a little pea under the shell and you try to figure out where is the pea, under which of the three shells. This is the game that the pharmaceutical industrialists play. They change their names routinely. They sell their different corporate entities. And that's how it's challenging to, beyond tracking the money, following where the P ends up. So the origin of the P is the same throughout the healthcare industry. You've got to go back and you've got to understand and fully appreciate what we're dealing with today. You've got to investigate IG Farben and the Rockefeller cartel. I call it the military medical petrochemical pharmaceutical cartel. Best name for it. It's one global beast. And so Bayer Corporation, Cipro, anthrax vaccine, smallpox vaccine, Baxter, Bioport, the Human Genome Project, and the origin of the Human Genome Project and what is taking place today in genetic engineering, you have got to understand, started way back in 1902. Dr. Levine at Rockefeller University Labs in New York and Cold Spring Harbor Labs in New York were funded for one purpose. They were funded to reduce population and the risk, the exposure that the corporate execs, the owners, you're talking about the Vanderbilts, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers, Rothschilds, these folks had, the Whitneys, the Bush family, Prescott Bush, the past president's grandfather and father, these people funded what was called eugenics. Today it's called genetics. Might as well keep eugenics. It's more accurate. It's defined as the scientific investigation of genetic differences between the races, including the genetic predispositions for diseases between the races. So later on, when you study the special virus cancer program that I've already shared with you, was the source of HIV type and Ebola-like viruses and the great plagues that we're witnessing now, largely vaccination intoxication for population reduction. You've got to understand that many of those studies had to deal with how are we going to find a risk for health and morbidity and mortality among Italians or Catholics or Jews or Hispanics. It was just given a new name. Eugenics is what it should be called today.
Well, that's Dr. Len Horowitz, a little extract from his talk. And I'll put a full version of that up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk. That talk took place at something called AV2 conference. I'm not sure the date, maybe about 2008, something like that. Certainly a while ago, but brought to the UK by Ian Crane, former chair of the UK 9/11 Truth Movement. By the way, I wonder how Ian's getting on after his near-death experience and his treatment in hospital, if you can call it a near-death. That's a bit cheeky, really. But, yeah, he was very, very ill. And hopefully he's getting more fully recovered. Be interesting to have a chat with him on here one of these days. But Martin there, he's talking about really effectively a massive cartel, including obviously the banks that finance all this,
but most importantly, the arms companies and the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, I mean, you can see where why people are going to start saying things like this, because there's a lot of evidence to suggest this is what's going on. And I'll mention in this context, I've got it in front of me because it's very hard to pronounce, Diljana Gaetandzieva, the Bulgarian...
No, hang on. Diljana Gaetandzieva.
No, I've got Gaetandzieva here.
Yeah, well, it's pronounced Gaetandzieva.
Well, okay. Well, maybe we can. My one says G A Y T A.
Yeah, well, this is what that's what she that's how she told me her name is pronounced.
Yes, okay. But I mean, she did very good work exposing how NATO was basically supplying ISIS with weapons from Eastern Europe, particularly from Bulgaria, where she's from, Brilliant. Via Azerbaijan. But also, she covered all of these biological warfare. Laboratories which have been developed in the former Soviet Union in the areas which are controlled by NATO, like Georgia, Ukraine, and other places. Now, we know that in the Korean War, because it was a Joseph Needham did a massive investigation of it, they used an awful lot of, and I sent you a new from an article last week about the use of viruses in Cuba in the 1980s. So you can imagine that the secret services within the communist countries are very well aware of the use of viruses, bacteriums, and chemical weapons as a method of warfare by NATO. And that all adds up and leads us to the potential conclusion that this whole crisis that we're going through has been created by the deliberate creation of a virus, the deliberate spreading of the virus in order to move to a control mechanism to control the world economy and the world population. The problem that they have is that as we speak, China has virtually eliminated the virus. And they're not using vaccines. They're using their political mobilization techniques and proper track and trace, which, of course, we don't have in this country.
They're using authoritarian methods and surveillance.
It's an authoritarian method, Tony, but it's also warfare is an authoritarian business. It isn't carried out by what's it Mao Zedong said, you know, a revolution is not a tea party. And, of course, if you're going to stop the fascists who are doing this, you'll have to do more than sing Kumbaya.
Well, that wasn't his best quote, was it?
There's an awful lot of truth in it. Trotsky said, those who say they don't believe in violence are like people saying they don't believe in gravity.
If you're going to dispute that and say that
everything can be solved without violence,
then that's an revolution.
But it's not really a serious...
No one has ever suggested that a revolution can be a tea party. And you have to use the evidence of Colonel Gaddafi, particularly in his peaceful coup that he did when he kicked out King Idris.
Yeah, but he still had to lock a few people up and shoot them, Tony. And of course, it wasn't an entirely libertarian system there either. It was quite a successful one. But certainly, if there was going to be a lockdown in Libya, Gaddafi would order a lockdown and he would have some hope that people would carry it out.
Gaddafi was so successful that he had to be destroyed. That's how successful he was with his Green Book and his...
Yes, and ultimately not very successful because he was destroyed. But the Chinese Communist Party was a bigger nut to crack.
It was because he was successful that he was destroyed. Is that what you said?
Well, I mean, that's what you said, and I tend to agree with you. Don't forget the Chinese had 30,000 of their people working in the Libyan oil industry. They had to send ships from China to take them all out. And all of the investment that the Chinese National Oil Company had made in Libya was just handed, or they intended to hand it to the Western oil companies. That hasn't quite worked out because the place is such a mess now that nobody can make anything of the oil. But, of course, the Chinese can't make anything of the oil, and that was probably an awful lot to do with what happened.
OK, well, look, before we wind up with our look at this marvellous Charles Galton Darwin, I suppose we ought to say something, Martin, didn't we, about the Biden inauguration this week. And also, it looks as if Mike Pompeo is going to be standing for Republican president in 2024.
Well, that's certainly what he's certainly flagging up. That's what he wants to do. He wants to take over where Trump left off. And he's been going around the world stirring up trouble to try and make things difficult for Biden, but also to make sure that everybody knows that he's lining himself up to be the next president when the next election.
Well, I think, it's also interesting that he was at the 2019 Bilderberg conference in Switzerland, which was held next to Mont-Pèlerin and Montreux. Now, that is something I think which is very significant. I've been discussing this with various people online. I think it's just amazing. This Mont-Pèlerin Society, the idea of Bilderberg having their conference next door to this mountain, which is such an important symbol for a lot of post-war right-wing financial gurus. So can you just give us an idea of what the significance of having, maybe not necessarily having Pompeo there, but for the Bilderbergers, the richest people in the Western world who have ambitions of globalism to control the entire planet and believe that they're nearly there, what is Mont-Pèlerin and the Mont-Pèlerin Society? Why is that significant to people who might want to have the Great Reset and change the world's financial system?
I believe it's Mont-Pèlerin.
Pèlerin. P-E-L-E-R-I-N.
The Mont-Pèlerin Society was set up by, as you say, right-wing money people in the 1940s because the post-war world was dominated by centre-left Keynesian ideas, the idea of a mixed economy, that you don't just have a private economy, you also have controls on banks, railways tend to be, and other infrastructure tend to be in the hands of the government. You have collective bargaining, global, national collective bargaining.
Look at Mont-Pèlerin is more to do with private wealth being absolute.
That's right. They were regarded at one stage as a bunch of cranks. As they were harking back to the 19th century, to a sort of pure capitalism without government intervention. It never existed, but it's a very, very powerful ideology. It should have been shot to pieces after the banking collapse of 2008. Worshippers at the Mont-Pèlerin ideology, as are many.
So it's almost like a kind of religion of money, where if you've got it, nobody can take it off you. The idea of a government taxing you is beyond the pale.
That's right. So in other words, at one stage, their views were regarded as fairly cranky. Then, of course, you had Reagan and Thatcher, who brought these views, these ideas back into the centre of Western policymaking. And, of course, that reached its apogee in the collapse of 2008. And as we were saying earlier, what should have happened at that point? Everybody should have just said, this is a load of rubbish and we've got to get rid of it. But, of course, there's Philip Mirofsky, who's a US academic, has done a very good studies of how they've managed to, despite everything, every crisis that comes along, their power grows. So they cause the crises. Everything is really to do with their misconceived ideas and selfish behavior. But as each crisis happens, their power becomes stronger. It's a sort of mechanism that was described by Naomi Klein in The Shock Doctrine. This is why it's so. And of course, having their meetings next to Mount Pèlerin, you can be damn well sure that a lot of the participants in these meetings at Bilderberg and so on know exactly what the significance is.
Yeah, of course.
That's why they have them there.
In fact, I'm ashamed to say that I, on the live program we did that day in 2019, I think probably with Charlie Skelton live at the same time, we didn't pick up on that, although we did play Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple, I seem to remember.
Well, look, the other thing that's interesting, of course, as you know, is that the Bilderberg Hotel was within side the what was the Kessel
Yeah, the Witch's Cauldron of the Arnhem. That's all in my book, The Traitors of Arnhem, which is available on the Martin Bormann Timeline tab at thisweek.org.uk. You can either get a free download copy or you can buy an ebook there, better quality with all the pictures and everything.
But Martin, that is, you know, it's very significant. The Bilderbergs, I think, you know, many of them, of course, we covered this a few weeks ago, are very, very deeply involved in the pandemic and particularly the reaction to it and the vaccine manufacturers' bonanza that's coming out of it. But, you know, in a way, you've got the Mont Pelerin people opposed to, you know, it's almost like a kind of new religion based on money that's coming along, and the old fashioned stuff to do with, you know, God, the Bible, that sort of thing is out the window.
Well, I mean, what you'll find in religious beliefs is that there's a spread of beliefs anyway. So you've got your left wing liberation theologians in Gustavo Gutierrez and others in Latin America. And you've got others who are extremely right wing, who believe that, you know, the state, basically fascist, the people who supported Franco and so on.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't really generalize about religion.
It's a good time to remember anyway. It's a good time to remember anyway that the love of money or the worship of money is the root of all evil. Finally, then, Charles Galton Darwin was director of the National Physical Laboratory during the Second World War and high up in the Manhattan Project. So that's interesting, isn't it? This is the grandson of Charles Darwin. Do you want to say something just briefly, Martin, about the sort of dark side of Darwin and this whole business of social Darwinism?
Well, social Darwinism was originally promulgated by Herbert Spencer, and it became very, very dominant in the late 19th century. And of course, modern Darwinianism and people who Darwinism is the basis of modern biological theory. But of course, social Darwinism extrapolated from what is a scientific theory into an explanation of social structures, which is, you know, these two things are not the same at all. And of course, it led to the whole idea of the survival of the fittest and all the rest of it. But in actual fact, modern, you know, those who work in the biological sciences, no, it's not the survival of the fittest. It's a lot of survival is to do with luck. I mean, you know, if we're all hit by an asteroid, it won't be the fittest that will be surviving. It'll be just the ones that didn't get hit by the asteroid. I mean,
I'm reminded very much of our conversation at the beginning of this show with the former detective David Leite, who's a victim of Lloyds Bank. We were talking there, weren't we, about that this financial system that we're in at the moment and the political system that we're in at the moment actually does promote a kind of law of the jungle, survival of the fittest, survival of the most devious.
Yeah, but that none of that is to be found in Darwin's scientific theory. It's actually an abuse. And of course, you know, Darwin was long dead by the time people like Spencer pushed his ideas.
Yep, this is the interesting thing, is this is his grandson, Charles Galton Darwin.
Oh, yeah, well, he
picked up on the dark side, and his Malthusian tendencies are apparently best described in his I've got a few quotes from his 1952 book, The Next Million Years, it's called. He says, another type of discovery may be connected with hormones, internal chemical secretions, which largely regulate the operations of the human body. The artificial use of hormones, he says, has already been shown to have profound effects on the behavior of animals. It's quite possible that drugs or hormones may have similar effects on man. In other words, there may be a drug which, without other harmful effects, removed the urgency of sexual desire and so reproduced in humanity the status of workers in a beehive. Or there might be another drug that produced a permanent state of contentment in the recipient. After all, alcohol does something like this already, though it has other disadvantages and is only temporary in its effects. A dictator would certainly welcome the compulsory administration of the contentment drug to his subjects. This is the kind of stuff that Huxley was talking about in Brave New World, Martin, I'm sure you're familiar with.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he talks about society as an ant's nest. Why cannot man set up a community like an ant's nest? This would be the ideal of the anarchist, and hitherto it has held no promise of all of success. But with the help of recent and probable future biological discoveries, he says some sort of imitation by man of the ant's nest cannot be excluded from consideration. There he is. He's just previously talking about worker bees and that sort of thing. Anyway, so thus the control of the numbers in the two sexes may become possible. And with the knowledge and the various sexual hormones, it might become possible to free the majority of mankind from the urgency of sexual impulse, which is what he was intimating earlier. And he carries on, so that they could live contented celibate lives instead of the unsatisfied celibate lives that are the compulsory lot of large faction of the present population of the world. But he actually then goes on in a rather shocking way to say, well, these discoveries could be made, and this is not impossible, that man should be able to carry out sex revolution, the typical characteristic of the insect civilization. So, wow, how about that for dumbing down, eh? He wants us all to be insects. The detail would, of course, have been quite different, for instead of one queen, there would have to be large numbers of fertile women to renew the population, whereas there might be one king, literally the father of his whole country. Now, this is a pretty amazing dystopian vision that this grandson of Charles Darwin is coming out with here, Martin. And I suppose it's a sort of perfect example of eugenics.
It is. And of course, it's got nothing to do with objective scientific theories. These are fascist projections from the sociological imagination of the already privileged, who see themselves, of course, as the future ruling class.
The future proletarian slaves. One commentator has wittily quipped, of course, his children and grandchildren went on to overpopulate senior positions in many prominent scientific and political institutions, including the Royal Society, which he was a big member of, and the Civil Service and the Foreign Office. So that's the witty quip at the end. I just thought
the only thing that really legitimized eugenics was the final solution during the Second World War. Up to that point, the wealthy classes openly discussed these things. And, of course, even some socialists went along with the eugenic ideas because they were just everybody was talking about them. And it was only because of the attempts by the Nazis to get rid of disabled people, etc., that it became, you don't talk about eugenics anymore. But you can be quite sure that in their clubs, while they're having a gin and tonic, these people pretty much think what they always thought about the so-called lower orders.
Yeah, nothing they certainly do. Changed. And the idea of perpetrating their own seed to take over the world. Yeah, that's the sort of thing I suppose the idle, super mega rich spend a lot of their time doing, at least some of them. I mean, I don't think it's fair to say, of course, not all wealthy people are like that, but there is a rather nasty...
There's a general culture of it.
I mean, there are a lot of wealthy people that don't think like that at all, and those are the people we want to hear from. Anyway, Martin, I think I'll just finish off with a little quip about the whole genetics thing, and Francis Galton, I believe, is the guy that started this thing called the Galton Institute about genetics, and I'll just tell you a little tale. Maybe you've heard similar sorts of things about the anti-genetic engineering campaigners back in 1996. I remember very well. Fantastic bunch of them, may even have been 95, that were going into central London and disrupting things like annual general meetings and even ordinary meetings at the Galton Institute in central London. And I can remember chatting to some people who'd been down there protesting with waving banners in the middle of their meeting and basically bringing the meeting of these eugenicists to a halt. And it was quite great. They were very, very entertained because, do you know what happened? They called the police, and after half an hour, it became clear the police were not going to come because the police knew, the Metropolitan Police, what the Galton Institute was, and they actually agreed with the protesters. So not a single policeman turned up to that to stop that protest inside the Galton Institute, and so they had to abandon the meeting and all go home. So that's all for now. Time to sign off. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summer, all the way through, and of course David Leitty from Cornwall, a victim of Lloyds Bank, describing in great detail his debacles with them over the years, and also the apparent complete lack of justice when it comes to, for the last 20 or even 30 years or so, anything to do with fraud and action fraud, the serious crime agency. All the agencies supposed to be doing anything about financial crime, doing absolutely nothing about financial crime. Also, thanks to studio engineer and sound recordist Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I am Shadow Band on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And you can request this show's reinstatement on FM. And links to email BCFM Chiefs are on the contact tab at our show page, thisweek.org.uk. Do please copy me in, though. And not a single person that has spoken to me so far has had a single reply from Pat Hart, our station manager. So at least that has been copied into me, and I've asked them all to do that. So do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the BBC banksters get you down.
Swim and pull you out.